the state governments could prohibit the use of peyote in religious ceremonies by Native Americans. Now, this would seem to be an express violation of part of the First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, that's use of peyote was free exercise of religion. In the case, no one denied that this was a legitimate Native American, that he had practiced this religion for many generations. No one suggested he was some guy just pretending to accept the religion in order to get the hallucinogen. And I'll be the first to recognize that this principle must have some limitation, as many aspects of the First Amendment do. I mean, after all, you can't shout fighter in a crowded theater, right? You don't have complete free speech. You can't libel somebody. And you can't practice any religion. There are religions that used to throw virgins into pits. I don't think you can practice a religion that throws virgins into pits. So I recognize there is some restriction on this principle. It's a difficult question. Scalia didn't recognize the difficulty of the decision in the opinion which he wrote. He said that where there are neutral principles, you can uphold them even when they prohibit the free exercise of religion. That was his point. In other words, if you're out to stop a religious practice, there was another decision to try to ban animal sacrifice in Florida to try to stop descendants of Haitians who practice voodoo, who did animal sacrifice, to try to stop their religion. He was willing to say that was wrong. You can't try to stop someone's religion. But here you had a neutral principle, which is no hallucinogenic drugs. And when you have a neutral principle, that trumps free exercise always, as long as you're doing it neutrally. In another very famous case, decided by Scalia, there was a case of an army medic who was Jewish who wanted to wear a kippah, a head covering. And the head covering was clean, and it didn't interfere in any way with his duties as a surgeon. It was attached to his head with clips, so it never fell out. And they said he couldn't do it because we don't allow anyone to wear head coverings in the ICU. And he said, it's my religion. I have a First Amendment right. And Scalia said, sorry, you lose. Neutral principle, doesn't matter how minor or unimportant it is, no head coverings, sorry, you lose your right to practice religion. So when it came to practicing Native American religions, when it came to practicing a Jewish religion, Scalia was clear. Anytime you have a neutral principle, you're banning head coverings or you're banning hallucinogenic drugs, well, that trumps religious free exercise. Okay, that is one way to view the Constitution. So I asked Justice Scalia, and this was, by the way, after his speech when he was talking with a group of students, about 8 or 9 of them, so it had a much smaller audience. But I decided to see whether Justice Scalia was going to be literal about what he said. Do neutral principles trump free exercise of religion? And I decided to go after his religion, the one he cares so strongly about, Catholicism. I said to him, if Congress were to pass a law requiring that the ministry of all religions be open to men and women, indeed, Congress were to pass a law saying there shall be no sex discrimination. Discrimination shall be solely based on competence for the job. No one shall be denied a job based on sex, male or female. No one shall be denied that. It's a neutral principle. It's not designed to take down the Catholic religion, but in doing so, sure, the Catholic religion would have to open up, at least in America, the priesthood to women, because it's a neutral principle. You're saying that no one can discriminate. I said, if Congress were to pass such a law, would it be constitutional? And he said to me, well, but Title VII has an exception for religious institutions. And he's right. The law that says you can't discriminate on the basis of sex does have an exception for religious institutions. That's true. I said, but what if it didn't, hypothetically? What if Congress passed a truly neutral law? One that said, as with the law against hallucinogens, as with the law against head coverings, that said that you must hire men and women equally, based on ability, not based on sex. Then, based on what you said in both of those cases, the peyote case and the yarmulke case, in both of those cases, you said when you have neutral principles, it trumps religious free exercise. You would agree then that if Congress were to say that no sex discrimination of any kind, whether in religious institutions or not, nowhere, neutral principle, then American Catholics would have to allow women to be priests, right? Long pause. Scalia is not one for long pauses. I got him to do a long pause. Long pause. He said, and this is a quote, "I'll get back to you on that," unquote. I said, "Well, why can't you answer the question now?" He said, "I told you I'll get back to you on that." I gave him my address. We didn't have email in those days. And you know what? I never got a response from Justice Antonin Scalia. Because it seems that where he's willing to use neutral principles to trump Judaism or Native American religions, he wasn't willing to use the same neutral principles to trump his own honored faith. And I'm not attacking Catholics here. What I'm saying is Scalia is a hypocrite. I proved it twice. I only wish that Leslie Stahl had asked him the questions that stumped him as well. I hope you enjoyed Law School 101 today, The Hypocrisy of Antonin Scalia. That's it for the Inside Scoop. Tune in for Bob Kincaid. Sorry I ran a little bit over. This is Mark Levine signing off.
Cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Well, I tell you what, for that kind of stuff, I will gladly give up 3 or 4 minutes of the program for Mark Levine. No doubt. No doubt about it. Good stuff, Mark. Very good stuff. Peeled Nino Bonino. There's our new word for him. Bonino Scalia. He peeled Bonino Scalia like a grape that was going to be handed to Pharaoh. Honest to God, he did, he did, he did. What a poison man Scalia is. You know, if it was, if I was a right winger, I could suggest. Well, if I was a right winger, I wouldn't suggest it because I'd think that he was a genius. Of course, we know after that last hour that Bonino Scalia is an overeducated moron. But no, if you're a conservative, you can get away with saying something like, "Isn't it about time that somebody put strychnine in Scalia's creme brulee?" But I'm a liberal. So if I said that, well, I'd have a guy in a dark suit with a skinny dark tie and dark glasses and talking to his wrist with a funny thing coming out of his ear and absolutely no sense of humor whatsoever on my damn doorstep. Because there is a double standard for liberals. Because after all, it was Adam's apple Annie Coulter who suggested that someone needed to put... Yeah, it was strychnine, wasn't it? strychnine in Justice Stevens' creme brulee. But so what? You know, I mean, Bill O'Reilly wants to lynch Michelle Obama. No harm, no foul. Manthrax Coulter says that the only shame of Timothy McVeigh was that he didn't park his truck in front of the headquarters of the New York Times. No biggie. That's humor. Rush Limbaugh tells a caller, call me back when you take the bone out of your nose. My friends, that's entertainment. I am an entertainer, and I do this kind of entertainment with one half my brain tied behind my back and talent on loan from God. Sickening. Really. But that reminds me of something. Oh, we've got all over the place to go today. But, no, I'm not going to start there. Hold up, back up. This is a very special day. Agnes and I, as of today, have been married for, 15 years. It astonishes me. I don't think I've ever done anything for 15 years in my life. This one we've managed to weather so far, and I hope we do until the end of it. And I hope the end of it is when we're chasing each other around on walkers when we're 156. One may, after all, engage in that kind of hope. But I got to tell you, if we had known, 15 years ago, that our wedding anniversary would be also transformed into an anniversary of American shame, an anniversary of American self-degradation, an anniversary of our short-sightedness and piggish tendency toward violence, I don't think we ever would have chosen May 1st for our wedding date. For my part, I chose it because it's May Day. That means it's international. It's the original Labor Day, and because it is also National Law Day. And I thought that was kind of cute. And I think back to that lovely day on that hilltop in West Virginia. Her in a beautiful, beautiful, springy white dress. Me in a tux. Me and all my groomsmen packing firearms under our coats. Agnes's ex-husband watching the wedding through the scope of a .30-06 with me in the crosshairs. And the moment when the preacher looked at her and said, do you take this man? And she said, wait! And all of my groomsmen reached into their coat pockets. They reached into the inside of their coats to unstrap their firearms. It was a little dicey back then, if you can't guess. And then Agnes began doing something approaching St. Vitus dance, which was really cute with her flaming red hair and her matching tinted glasses and the beautiful wreath of flowers in her hair and the gorgeous white dress and the pretty pumps. And she begins doing this sort of insane, you know, caught in the spirit, you know, kind of dance, and she manages to get out of her mouth, bee down my dress. Bee down my dress. At which point, her bridesmaids all went over and began doing... You know, I guess there's a reason for bridesmaids. I never thought of it before then, but... Yeah, because when the bee goes down the bride's dress, everything goes sideways at the wedding. Those of you young enough to be yet contemplating marriage, who are might be contemplating an outdoor ceremony, would do well to remember that bees do sometimes find their way down the bride's dress. It was down the back of the dress, so there wasn't really anything she could do, and Agnes is allergic to bee stings. So everybody, you know, reholstered firearms. And the bridesmaids helped to evict said apian guest at the festivities. It was a beautiful day. Not a cloud in the sky. Agnes and I catered our own wedding. Served up tons and tons and tons of hickory smoked chicken and pulled pork, homemade sauce and hot slaw, and all the goodies that go with it. And there was a vast, vast zinc galvanized horse watering trough filled with ice and ice cold long neck beers and champagne. It was a beautiful, beautiful day, and one that I will cherish for the rest of my life. And how was I to know that 10 years later, on our 10th anniversary, a pig-eyed, jug-eared, little martinet of a lout with a padded crotch would land on an aircraft carrier mere miles off the coast of San Diego, so close, in fact, that it was necessary to turn the ship around so that San Diego wouldn't appear in the background of the TV publicity shots, thereby making a monkey out of our chimperer. How was I to know that? How was I to know? How was Agnes to know? We were in love, and we only wanted to make sure that we had picked a Saturday where we hoped there wouldn't be rain for a wedding on a hilltop. How were we to know? Of course, there was no way to know. There was no way to know that 10 years later, and 3 babies, we'd be huddled around the television set, watching, just like a scene from Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, the triumphal aircraft, the Viking aircraft, with our hero president at the helm, land on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln. How are we to know that the banner that hung behind him that said mission accomplished had been crafted in the spin dungeons of the White House, and that the White House itself and its evil minions would blame the banner on the swabs and salts and Airedales and pilots of the USS Abraham Lincoln? How were we to know? How were we to know that when the repig-licking sons of bitches who orchestrated that entire nightmarish load of crap and said, well, we expect to begin the troop drawdown in a matter of weeks or months. How were we to know that another 5 years later, we would be measuring George Bush's Iraq War dead at over 4,000 Americans, not counting those killed in Afghanistan, and measuring the civilian dead in their own land in 7 digits. How are we to know? We couldn't know. Oh, such a beautiful day it was. My mother and father were both there. Neither one here now. We only had the one young'un then. 3 more would follow. And 15 years from that day, we would be grandparents twice over. How were we... The things... We don't know. No one has a crystal ball. No one has a crystal ball on their wedding day. No one gets to look down the roads and years and days and see what's coming. No one. And that's the difference between that anniversary and this hateful anniversary of Mission Accomplished. Because so many of us saw it coming. We knew that even from a karmic standpoint, you cannot attack a country that is doing you no harm and invade it and occupy it and expect it to come out well. We knew, those of us who study history, and that includes the majority, if not the entirety, of this audience, we knew that time after time after time after time down through human history, invaders have almost always wound up the losers. We know. And so we knew on that day of Mission Accomplished that no good would come of it. And no good has. Oh, the right wing's been out there for years now, years trying to... Oh, look, they built the soccer field! If we turned Iraq into one great big lush grassy green soccer field, that grass would grow in sand sodden with blood. Blood unrighteously shed. We know. We just know. And like Cassandra of ancient Troy, gifted with the ability to predict the outcome of events, but cursed concomitantly with the fact that no one would believe her, we knew that when shock and awe began, and we knew that when that idiot landed on that aircraft carrier, we knew that it was just another load of crap. We didn't know exactly how much so, but we knew. Oh, we knew. And let's take a moment, if you will, to remember someone who had no idea when he joined up what his fate would be. Let us take a moment of silence, of prayer, of looking up until the tears well. Let's take a moment to remember Sergeant First Class David L. McDowell, who was 30 years old, who came from Ramona, California, who fell dead Tuesday in Afghanistan from what is referred to as small arms fire. Let us remember Sergeant First Class David L. McDowell, perhaps as the face of this militaristic nightmare that is the 8-year torment called the Bush presidency. For you see, Sergeant First Class David L. McDowell was on his 7th deployment. He had received 2 Bronze Stars and a Purple Heart already when he was cut down by small arms fire. He had been deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq 7 times and had proven himself 3 times over a hero, and was deployed a 4th, a 5th, a 6th, and an unlucky 7th time. Truly, he is the face of the Bush War. A man who should have been afforded his rest the first time he was a hero, but wasn't. Who should have perhaps been sent home the second time he was a hero to help bolster recruiting. Who on the third time he was a hero should have been sent home by a grateful nation but wasn't. But was instead in his 30th year rotated into Afghanistan for the 7th time, where he was shot to pieces. 7 rotations. 7 rotations. This is Iraq and Afghanistan. This is not the Second World War. I've seen my dad's World War II Navy ID. It has on it induction date, and for separation date, it has one word. It says duration. This is not that war. This is not that war because this war is longer than that war. This is not that war because that war had achievable goals. Defeat Hitler, defeat Mussolini, and defeat the Empire of Japan. Because those were 3 rogue, murderous nations gone hellishly wrong. Such was not the case with Iraq. Iraq was not a belligerent. Iraq was not threatening the borders of its neighbors. If you could have heard last night Ray McGovern laying out the case as a prosecutor lays out an indictment against some common street thug, you would have heard him noting something similar. I apologize for the technical difficulties last night, by the way. Without sounding like I'm making excuses, it wasn't my fault. The facility there left me nothing but a wire, with the assumption that that would carry the PA audio into our equipment. Unfortunately, it was plugged into something that wasn't the same thing as what Mr. McGovern was using to do his speaking with. So, sorry. But you would have heard that. You would have heard the evidence that you already know. You would have seen on a big screen, because I was taping, Colin Powell saying Saddam Hussein is absolutely unable to present a credible threat to his neighbors. You would have seen it. And it was... It's all stuff that we're familiar with, but when you're confronted with it, you know, staring you in the face, a man like Colin Powell, who had been arguably honorable in his life up until his association with the thugs of the Bush family, who then took his reputation and flushed it down the toilet for him, you would have almost felt a little sick in the bottom of your stomach. Until you realized that he took that phony baloney evidence that privately we all know now that he referred to with a barnyard manure epithet, and took it and soldiered into the United Nations and lied his ass off. If it weren't for that, you almost would have felt sorry for Colin Powell. But Colin Powell is a millionaire. Colin Powell is comfortable beyond his wildest expectations. Colin Powell has been dipped by the heel in Iraqi blood, and he still has no problem at all shaving every morning. Colin Powell has a lot of advantages that Sergeant First Class David L. McDowell never had, among which was the opportunity to finish a military career without being ground through the ringer of the Bush administration's mistreatment of our military. Let that just swirl around between your ears for a little bit. That man was rotated to Afghanistan and Iraq 7 times. And I'm sure there's some right-winger out there saying, "Oh, yeah, maybe he volunteered for him, Bob." Maybe he did. But maybe if we didn't have an overstretched, overextended, horrifically abused military structure, his having volunteered would not necessarily have wound up in his reality. We've heard a great deal about the number of suicides, even though they were hidden by the VA. We've heard a great deal about the number of suicides, and you can't help wondering, in those suicides, what statistical portion of them were comprised of men and women who said, "I'm not going back. They can't make me go back. I'll end it right now. I'll stop the questioning. I'll keep them from sending me back." And did so with the only method available to them. Because you know that statistically it is impossible that some of those suicides not be from that situation. It just has to be. Like all the stories we've had over the years of a phenomenon that we weren't even familiar with to begin with, mostly young men committing something called suicide by cop, where a young man slated to be redeployed goes and holds up a liquor store or puts up some sort of a hostage situation until the cops finally bring the SWAT team in and put a bullet through his head because he didn't want to do it himself. Happy anniversary, George! Happy anniversary, Dick! Happy Mission Accomplished Day, Condi! Happy Mission Accomplished Day, Wolfowitz and Pearl and Edelman and Fife and Rumsfeld! Did any of you have the time today to go and lay a wreath at the tomb of anyone who died as a result of your arrogance, your hubris, and your profound ignorance? I don't even have to put forward the hypothetical answer, because you know what the reality is. How do we justify 7 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan? Listen, let's assume for a moment that the poor fella did volunteer. After the third or fourth time he volunteered, I think it's time for a screening, don't you? Because that ain't right. That's just not right. I don't fully comprehend how exactly to note all the slimy, icky, filthy emotions that this fifth anniversary of Mission Accomplished generates in me. There's Dana Perineal, referred to me by our good friend ELO, the moderator in our chat room, as Spinderella. That's just precious. Who, smarmy-like, and with a level of disdain that would just bring dinner up, looked at the assembled Johnny-on-the-spot White House press corps and said,
President Bush is well aware that the banner should have been much more specific and said mission accomplished for these sailors who are on this ship on their mission. And we have certainly paid a price for not being more specific on that banner. And I recognize that the media is going to play this up again tomorrow, as they do every single year.
First of all, Dana, you damn dummy, it's media are, not media is. It's plural. But I don't guess you got the memo, did you? Flippin' moron.
And we have certainly paid a price for not being more specific on that banner. Oh, eat crap and die, Dana!
You have not paid a price. Prices are paid in this war in blood and sweat and tears. And the agony of those left behind by the vain waste of their loved ones' lives. You evil harpy. You pestilent virago. You sickening hag.
Well, we've certainly paid a price.
7 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. The young man had 7 tours. 2 bronze stars and a purple heart.
We've certainly paid a price for it.
Obviously, I could never serve as a member of the Johnny on the Spot White House press corps because I don't have the temperament for it. Because at some point in time, if you've got any morals at all, which the White House press corps doesn't, if you've got any values at all, which the White House press corps doesn't, if you've got any soul or heart at all, which the White House press corps doesn't, you stand up and you say, how dare you? How dare you sit here in this air-conditioned, temperature-controlled, climate-monitored room and look at us with our little notebooks and our little pens scratching away and our microphones and our cameras and tell us about the price that you've paid. How dare you? And then I'd be fired. And I'd have to start up an internet radio show. Quibbling.
The banner should have been more specific and said mission accomplished for these sailors who are on this ship on their mission.
Hell, they wouldn't, like I said, they wouldn't even admit that the White House was the ones who did the banner. They blamed that on the sailors who just wanted to get home to their families after a long deployment. And Chris Matthews says, we love our president. We like for our president to be a real guy. Real men fight their own damn wars. So that's a starting place for tonight. It's an anniversary evening. Where were you? Where were you the first time you saw that vile piece of flesh step onto the deck of that aircraft carrier? Where were you? What do you remember of it? Did you believe it at the time? Did you believe that it was just one and done? Were you suckered? Were you brought in? Were you taken in? Were you hoodooed? Did you believe it for a minute? Or did the whole thing smell a little too much like the Carnival Midway? You know, that sort of heavy, sick, sweet smell that's about a half a cross between cotton candy and elephant poop. Did you bite? You didn't bite. None of us here bit. We knew we were on the Carnival Midway, and we knew that those games are never rigged for you to win. Ah, you're good at this. Why don't you put down $10? Ooh, you won my $10 bill. Want to go for 20? And the next thing you know, he's got your 10, your 20, your other 10, and everything else you had in your pocket. Hey, look, it's the American budget! The Pentagon has gotten its budget. It's gotten the American manufacturing sector's budget. It's gotten our social services budget. It's gotten state budgets. It's gotten the family budgets of people who do things like serve 7 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. Welcome to the Midway, kid. All the mirrors ain't just in the funhouse, you know. Let's go to the phones. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob, it's Cassie.
Hey, Cassie, how are you, dear?
Good, good. I remember when I saw it, this. I was in, I saw it at school.
Oh, really?
And we had it on the news. We do the news every morning. There's a 10-minute news on the TV.
Oh, yeah. What is that? One News or something like that?
Channel One.
Yeah.
So they had it on Channel One, and I believed it. I was 11, but so maybe that's my excuse. I don't know about the rest of the country. But my brother had just joined the military. Mm-hmm. Like 5 months before that, or 6 months before that, and I remember being really glad that Iraq was finished, and so that he wasn't going to have to go anywhere.
You had a sense of relief.
Yeah.
How long did it last, Cassie?
Like a week or two until things started getting worse and stuff.
Well, when that happened, did you feel like somebody had been lying to you, or did you just say, well, you know, it's too bad it turned out this way? I'm asking because I sincerely want to know. This is not a snarky question or anything. Did you feel like...
I did not think anybody was lying to me. I was not politically aware very much at that point, and I didn't like Bush, but I didn't think that the whole thing was a lie.
Yeah, 5 years is a third of your life, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. And you weren't used to adults lying to you, were you?
Well, kind of, but not like that.
Right.
President.
Yeah.
I mean, this is also before my mom went to jail. So
yeah, they weren't preaching lying.
Life was pretty crazy at my house.
Yeah. I can imagine. But they weren't telling you that sometimes in fifth grade or so. In fifth grade classrooms, they weren't exactly telling you that presidents are in the lying business, were they?
No, not at all.
Well, looking back on those 5 years, what is your verdict now, Cassie?
Well, I think that Bush and Rumsfeld and all of them made up the whole weapons of mass destruction thing, and I think that they wanted to go to Iraq from even before the 9/11, and I think that they were looking for an excuse, and when they found it, they took it, and they didn't care if any of it was true. And they got the whole country to think that war was a good idea. Because I remember I did see TV at home also, besides, Channel 1. And on TV at home, everybody thought the war was a good idea. And you didn't, I had no idea that there were protests about the war and that there were protests with millions of people in other countries. I didn't know about that until 2 years ago.
And how did you find out?
From listening to the radio and reading blogs and stuff. And when they did the protest in New York, I guess it was in September, a year and a half or 2.5 years ago. And they were talking about how the press doesn't cover it and how the press didn't cover all of the protests before the war. And I had no idea there were protests before the war.
Do you, standing here and looking back, 5 years, like I said, is a significant portion of your life.
Yeah.
What is it? Has it changed you? Has it changed the way it feels to grow up? Is it possible to know that?
Has the war or
the war and the dirty sort of criminal way that it has been prosecuted?
Well, what it feels like is that all the stuff in the textbooks is a lie. And most of the stuff on TV is a lie, except for Oberman and Jon Stewart. But, everything else, it feels like isn't, even when we learn about the Constitution or we learn about anything that, in United States history or what our rights are or any of it, that it's all a lie now, that none of it is real. And I think that people older than me didn't know that at my age, thought that it was real for a lot longer time.
I did. I'll tell you the truth. I did. I mean, I was graduating high school when Ronald Reagan came into office.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized that there was some phony baloney to it all. But I believed in the underlying principles of the Constitution.
Right.
And I believed in the intentions of the people who set it all up. That's all, and I'm talking to you from the perspective of a 45-year-old man. That's all been taken away from me, too, Cassie.
Well, I think the intentions are still there. But I think that there's so few people in Washington who want to have anything to do with following that intention. I think that there are either want to do what's better for the corporations or they want to do what's better for, for themselves. And they are so much more interested in money and they're not really interested in what's good for the country and they don't really understand what it's like for regular people because that's not who they're. They don't represent us. They don't, we don't matter.
So when
I'm tired of not mattering.
Amen to that. Give me a few million of folks your age who are tired of not mattering, and we'll We'll change the world. You know, I forget who the philosopher or whatever was said, you know, give me a large enough fulcrum and I'll move the planet or some such stuff as that. Are you alone in this, or are there others that you talk with in your day-to-day experience who share, who don't look at you like you have three heads when you try to, you know, talk politics?
Well, you know that online I hang out with kids who are also interested in politics and kids who are also liberal, even though our blog kind of fell apart. But, I mean, my blog is still going, but You Think Left is, nobody ever writes it anymore. But anyway, but I still am friends with people who really care. But most of them are not people that I know that I see at school.
What about at school? Do you see kids graduating and signing, choosing to sign up with the military for want of being able to go to college, that kind of stuff?
Some, yeah. There's some who do that, but there's more who do community college part-time and work full-time. That's a lot more common.
What does it make you feel like, Cassie, what you've just described, this business of I'm tired of not mattering. Does it make you want to go forward? Does it make you want to duck your head? Do you want to? Can you imagine
You want to fight back. That's why I ended up applying to that Cornell thing, even though I was kind of scared to get on an airplane, because I'm not gonna just not matter. I'm going to figure out a way to matter. That's why I started a blog. That's why I call radio stations. That's why that's why I write. That's why I talk to people about stuff when they say something like, you know, I can't afford gas or, oh, it doesn't matter if I get a car or not because I can't afford to put gas in it or whatever that I hear from friends of mine. And it's like, well, you know, that's because George Bush only helps the oil companies and doesn't help us. And I say stuff to them.
So do your fellow classmates know what a little radical you are, Cassie?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. How could they not?
So you don't hide from it in your day-to-day interactions, then? You wear it on your sleeve, so to speak.
I'm just me, yeah.
Well, so far, just me is turning out to be a pretty doggone good human being, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, thank you.
And you had let me shift gears on you for a minute. You had a Jim Dandy little blog posting the other day about your experience with standardized testing. Does that give you an idea of what the so-called grown-ups think of the educational process?
Well, they just want us to be able to answer those kinds of questions. And they want us to spend the whole year learning how to answer those kind of questions. And we don't get to other stuff until now. My last test is tomorrow. And tomorrow is social studies. And then after social studies, I'm done. And then we have 4 more weeks of school or 5 weeks? I think we have 5 weeks. So for 4 weeks, we might learn other things that are not on the test, and then it's exam. School exam.
I don't... So the last 4 or 5 weeks is sort of kind of a blow-off?
Well, no, but that's like...
I don't mean you. I mean, this is... What's left after the standardized test? How can they teach the test when the test is over?
Right, so that's when they teach other stuff. But some of the other stuff is, like, the more important stuff.
And they have to cram it into 5 weeks of an otherwise, what, how many instructional days, school year, 167 days, something like that?
180, I think.
180, and you get 5 weeks for stuff that matters.
Yeah.
So I know I've got a little bit of an idea because of our correspondence what your class load is like and what your schedule's like. When you saw this standardized testing, how much of what you've learned, really learned, the stuff that matters, how much of that was brought to bear inside the test?
English, very little. On math, I think I don't know which parts matter yet. I think until you know what you're doing with math, you don't know which parts matter. So I don't know. The science test was actually pretty good. And social studies, the test is mostly, it's some world history and some world geography, which is important stuff to learn. But the one that's the worst is the English, the language arts.
How so?
Because in real life, when do you ever read something where you read a fiction piece and a nonfiction piece about exactly the same topic or about similar topics and then have to compare them or answer questions about both of them together? Or when in real life do you have to read to show that you understand a newspaper ad and how it relates to a fiction piece? It's like it's all bogus. There's nothing. When I had to write...
There's no relevance? Is that what we're getting at?
Right. Right. There's nothing... Like, when I had to write a letter to my congressmen and my senators and stuff 2 years ago, I didn't... Nobody had ever taught us since, like, third grade how to write a proper letter or how to write a letter to a congress. Like, was it Dear Mr. Governor or is it Dear Mr. Representative or, like, how do you do that? And I had to have help with all of that. Because nobody ever taught us those things. So, like, that's... It seems like if our country's going to be in trouble, what we need to be doing is to write to our congressmen and write to our senators and protest and stuff. But that's what they should be teaching us, and they haven't... There's nothing about that.
What have you been taught so far about real governmental structure?
I mean, we've been taught about the three branches, but nothing about the unitary executive.
Well, that's mainly because it's not in the Constitution, but we'll just, yeah.
Right. But we learned about the branches of government. We learned about which things are state and which things are federal. We learned the history of how the government was put together, both, like, in the 1770s, how it was put together, and 1780s. But also when different states were added, and then the Civil War and after the Civil War.
How about science? For those who don't know, you're in Texas, and you are in the enlightened liberal oasis of Texas.
Right.
Has any of the fundamentalist stuff that we see so much of intruded upon your educational experience?
Not much. Our health class had stuff about, my health class had sex education in it, and it had, you know, how to not become pregnant and not just say no. It had other stuff like condoms and diaphragms and coils and all of that stuff.
Hardware.
So it had some of that. It had a lot about diseases, and different kinds of diseases. It had stuff about drug addiction, but it didn't, you know, I know that when I talk to people in the liberal world, like on the blogs or in the chat rooms and stuff, that people seem to see a big difference between pot and the other drugs, and our textbook and our teacher didn't.
That's probably a legal function. Under the circumstances, okay. I'll stay away from that topic.
Okay.
But how many more years of high school do you have left?
2 years and 5 weeks.
So, you've talked about wanting to make a difference. Are you beginning to look at how you manifest that desire? What you go on and do after high school? Are you thinking about...
I'm going to college. For sure I'm going to college. I'm going to go to a four-year college. And I don't know... I want to be a journalist, but it sounds like a lot of the journalism stuff is pretty corrupted also. And, like, if you're not a blogger and you work for a magazine, you have to write the stuff that sells magazines or sells newspapers and not the stuff that's important. But I don't think you can earn money by just being a blogger. So I don't know. I have to figure that out. but I might do some stuff with photojournalism. I want to go into politics.
I was wondering if we were going to get there.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I want to become president in 2032, and I already know who my running mate is. And you know him.
Yes.
Casey Birch is going to be my running mate. And
Cassie and Casey, 32. I think it's got a great ring.
Yep. And I'm on the top of the ticket because I decided first.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But I've also been talking to people who say that being a political activist or being, like, not a lobbyist, but somebody, whatever the liberal kind of a lobbyist.
Community organizer?
Right. That is might be a place to start also.
Seems reasonable.
So I'm not sure quite what I'm going to end up with.
Well, here's the bonus. You don't have to be sure.
I'm definitely going to college, and I'm definitely going to, work towards some of that and, you know, try and get, like, summer jobs and stuff and see what I like best and what seems to work and all of that.
And so you're still in major excitement mode about the Cornell gig, right?
Yes, absolutely. I'm doing Cornell this summer. I'm going to up to Dallas for my brother's wedding this summer. And I'm also going to be working for Rick Noriega's Senate campaign.
Yeah.
And I've talked to a couple people there. The paid interns, they want you to commit to a whole block of summer, and I'm not going to have a block. I'm going to have 2 weeks, and then 1 week, and then 2 weeks. So it may not be a paid internship, but I'm going to try and I'm still working with them to figure it out.
But you're working on figuring it out, and I think that puts you about 50 miles ahead of a whole lot of the folks that, well, you know. I've seen your writing. You've got a pretty solid thumb on the pulse of what's going down inside your school. So I don't know. I can't help but be fairly certain that you're going to wind up ahead of the curve. And I hope you know how incredibly proud we all are of you here at the Horn. I know you've talked with Peter and you've talked with John and with me. Have you ever talked to Guy?
No, because he's on during the day.
That's what I thought. Probably during your school time.
I talked to Dr. Bill once.
Yeah, you did. You did. Maybe during the summer when you've got a little break, you ought to have a conversation with Guy too, because he's he is absolutely chock-a-block with wisdom and with perspective that even I don't have. I'm just hardcore and cranky. Guy has a much more considered wisdom than I do. So I hope you'll give him a call too sometime. And in the meantime, I know you're out there. You're working to make a little money here and there. We were going to talk a couple of nights ago, but pardon?
Can we say the name of my blog?
You can say the name of your blog twice. You can say it 10 times if you want to.
Okay. FrecklesCassie.wordpress.com.
And that's Cassie, Cassie.
Yes.
Wonderful.
FrecklesCassie.wordpress.com.
And I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but for those who haven't seen it, go and catch the blog post with regard to Cassie's recent slog through the standardized testing ordeal.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, which mercifully ends tomorrow.
Then we have our district test, and then we have our final.
What?
So we're not. Do we have a 6 week test?
Oh, for pity's
sake.
And
then we have our final.
I mean, I understand the necessity of testing and making sure if the knowledge is getting through. But you'll find that you will find, for instance, when you get to college, that you may take a class where there's only one exam, and it comes at the end of the semester, and that's the whole grade.
So you can actually learn stuff the whole week, the whole time.
You learn stuff the whole time, and then if you happen to screw up the exam, too bad. But
is that why college is 2 weeks shorter than high school? Because they don't with the test.
I don't know that they all are. That varies from institution to institution and state to state.
Well,
you know, and some are on quarters, and some are on semesters, and some are on trimesters.
University of Texas starts a week later than us and ends 2 weeks earlier than us, or a week earlier each semester.
There's probably a little bit more crammed into that too, but I hate to say pity, but I do you for having to put up with this. And I get mad about this time every year, Cassie, just so you can know, because you know I've got Agnes and I have our own, and
right.
I have literally seen my daughter going out the door ready to vomit because of the pressure that is put on students to do well in these tests. And because our kids are relatively intelligent, they get more pressure put on them to excel so that they can help carry the ones who don't.
Oh, see, here, if I got a 71 or I got 100, it doesn't change anything. So the school doesn't care. So if I got a 71, as long as I get more than 70, then it's counted as passing. And I can't bring anyone else up.
I'll never forget the year that the students, the principal looked at the students, my kids included, and said, y'all have to do really good on this test, because if you don't, I might lose my job next year. And I wouldn't be here then.
My teacher has said that, and my principal has said that.
That's a little bit dirty, isn't it, Cassie? I mean, they could be the best teacher or principal in the world, but that's...
Well, I know one kid who had a really hard time with the test, because she has a hard time reading, and she was crying after the test, not because she was going to fail or do summer school or any of that. She was crying because Miss Maureen was going to lose her job if we didn't do well. Everybody likes Miss Maureen.
What a lousy load to put on the backs of...
This was in seventh grade.
I know. That's it was in the primary grade school that my kids got this put on them. You know, nobody was older than fourth grade.
That's crazy. The whole thing is crazy.
And what I'm getting from you is it doesn't teach anything.
The math, I don't know. The math is some of it is okay, but it's not real practical. I learned a lot more practical math from my brother, actually, from, like, shopping and buying stuff and
learning to calculate tax rates in your head and stuff like that, sure.
Right, and also things like, if it's 10 cents cheaper at this store, but we're going to use this much gas to get there and back, you know, are we going to save money? And, like, how many would we have to buy and that kind of stuff? Because he, in addition to...
And name brand versus store brand and...
Right. But in addition to his work with the military, he does a lot of car mechanic stuff on the side. He does stuff in our garage or he goes to people's houses. And... He's always talking to me. I mean, like, I still don't know quite what a carburetor is, but don't tell me. I really don't care.
Well, I won't tell you, because in another couple of years, it practically doesn't matter now.
Okay, but...
Carbureted automobiles are a thing of the past.
What is a thing of the past?
Carbureted automobiles.
Oh, okay. But...
If you've got a car with a carburetor on it, you've got a really old car.
Well, he works on some old cars.
Yeah.
But he'll talk about, like, how much time it's going to take him to do something and how that affects what he charges. And it's not just, you know, $8 an hour or $12 an hour or whatever. It's, like, it's more complicated. And that's real math, or figuring out our budget and, you know, what we have money for this month or what we don't is real math. and a lot of the stuff at school is not.
You've hit on something, Cassie, because that is real math. And if you want, by comparison, if you want to know what phony math is talking about billions and trillions of dollars and throwing it around like it really belongs to you. Like, say, for instance, when the Fed met and gave a $32 billion bailout to Bear Stearns, you know, the Wall Street Investment Bank, that $32 billions, you can't contemplate a billion of anything.
Right.
But you can sure contemplate how far your grocery budget goes, can't you?
Yeah.
Precisely. Well, you are on the right path, Cassie.
But the other thing about the test?
Yeah.
So I'm in 10th. So most 10th graders are in geometry, but some of us are in Algebra 2, and some kids who failed Algebra 1 are still in Algebra 1. You could be in any different class and still be in 10th grade, but we all took the same standardized test. We all took the same text test. So what our teacher did for the last 2 weeks was to have us go over all the geometry stuff that we might have forgot. But I don't. The kids who were in Algebra 1, I don't know what their teacher did to get them to pass.
Pray. That's where you just pray. And for anybody who thinks that there's no prayer in schools, they've never seen a teacher before standardized test week praying that her kids get through it.
Right.
So do you see teachers come and go as a result of this stuff? I mean, they've threatened and they've...
Oh, I don't think anybody, no teacher that I know has lost their job from it.
Is your school within acceptable parameters for test scores?
Yes.
Okay, probably not then. Cassie, it's awfully good to hear.
My high school was accepted.
Well, hang in there. Get through the next 5 weeks and... of course, as ever, let us know when something new hits the blog. FrecklesCassie.wordpress.com, correct?
Yes. Thank you.
Go there. Read it, everybody. Talk to you later, Cassie.
Bye.
Bye. Inspiring, that young woman is. Right, inspiring. Well, if you're new to the program, you see now how conversation radio works. If you're old to the program, well, maybe you want to participate. See, I had standardized. I remember standardized testing as a kid. I think we had the California Achievement Test in like second grade, fifth grade, seventh grade, 3-4 year intervals. And it went on for a day and then it was over. And I don't seem to be, well, some would argue that I don't seem to be any the worse for not having been tested every year. But let's remember, please, that standardized testing is a racket. Quick, here's one of those multiple choice test questions, just like on the test. Who made a fortune off of the Bush administration's insistence that there be annual standardized testing? A. Fred Funkenstein. B. Sally Kitzmiller. C. Neil Bush. D. Neil Bush. E. Neil Bush. F. Neil Bush. Marvin? Was it Marvin? I thought it was Neil. Maybe it was Neil and Marvin. It was the Bush family. Sucking at the federal teat since 1915. Lordy. Hey, let's take a quick break and come back after that. Your phone calls, you know, they're always welcome. 877-443-2366 is the number. 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel instead of ours, 304-658-3333. This is America's liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart? For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here is the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Hey, how's that for an appropriate bumper? I love that song. And in many ways, the lyric to that song reflects an optimism of 50 years ago about the prospects for what it would mean in the future to grow old in America. If you should survive to 105, think of all you'll derive just from being alive. I suppose we do have a number of 105-year-olds in this country. For the most part, they lie, as we speak, warehoused in nursing home facilities. Because their children are too harried and too swamped in work to be able to continue to have them be part, and I might add, a very valuable part of their world. And of course, the beautiful thing about that is, since the American working class is driven like cattle with electric prods going gangbusters behind them, when they take long enough to put mom or grandma in the home, they don't think about that. When they walk out and they go, I don't care how much they clean that place smells like urine, because they do. They don't really think about the fact that that's going to be their lot someday. Here in 2008, we have the first couple of generations of Americans who have found themselves in their elder years warehoused. Not something to be proud of, frankly. And if, while you are working yourself into either a senescent old age or an early grave, you stop to think about it, it's harrowing. It is indeed harrowing. So we can move on to some other stuff. We can talk about anything you want to talk about, if, in fact, there's something that is particularly speaking to you. A couple of tidbits here. Just stuff that I found interesting. Stuff to be kind of proud of. India. I found this over at Larissa Alexandrovna's blog at Largely. She says, recently the Bush administration took it upon itself to unilaterally, that's my word, not hers, advise India that ahead of the Iranian president's visit, India should tell Iran to behave responsibly and meet United Nations Security Council requirements with regard to its nuclear program. Of course, India is probably not likely to do that because India didn't either. But you admire the spunk of India because India turned around and told the Bush administration to piss off and mind its own business. That, in fact, India and Iran are grown up enough to manage their own diplomatic affairs without George Bush meddling in them. Good on ya, India! Little golf clap. From the 14th green. Parts of External Affairs Minister... Oh, dear God. Part of External Affairs Minister Pranab Mukherjee's response had the feel of a direct snub. We are advising Iran that since it is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, it has some obligation to international treaties. We tell the U.S., do not take on yourself the responsibility of whether Iran was manufacturing weapons or not. Leave it to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the designated authority. Yeah, no dirty words in there, but a great, just the same. Hey, George, stick, here's one of our Indian mangoes. Put it where the sun don't shine, buddy. But of course, the important part of that is there are channels. There are appropriate channels by which these disputes are to be resolved. None of which involve allowing the United States to blow the snot out of something. Okay, and this is my one little smart aleck moment for the night. You can take me to task for being a knuckle-walking Neanderthal. Beautiful headline, Greenpeace takes over Czech missile defense site. Again, from At Largely. Greenpeace activists on Monday took over the site in a military zone southwest of Prague in the Czech Republic where the United States would like to place its missile defense radar. About 20 activists scaled the hill without a permit to enter the Brdy military zone in protest of U.S. plans. As someone who speaks for a living and occasionally pretends to hold out to the world that he even reads for a living, words like Rudy drive me nuts. This place where these heroic Greenpeace activists took over the hilltop site is spelled B-R-D-Y. You'll forgive me if I submit that the Czech Republic does not need missile defense radar nearly so much as it desperately needs us to send them some damn vowels. I have no idea if it's Brudy, Barty, Birdy, Bordy. You get the idea. But honest to God, this is one of the places where the United States wants to put the radar that goes in with the super double secret probation Ronnie Reagan official got it out of a box of Cracker Jacks radar missile shield boondoggle. Really? That's going to protect the Czech Republic from the Iranian nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles that Iran, for reasons known only inside the sort of squirrely rat feces infested brain of George Bush, is going to shoot at the Czech Republic. No, really. This story doesn't get a hell of a lot of coverage. And I'm not talking about the by a vowel part. This business of our insistence on get done with the pretext here? This has nothing to do whatsoever with Iran attacking Central Europe. This has to do with putting up an electric wall around the former Soviet Union and putting a fence between the Soviet, again, a virtual electronic fence, again with the fences of the Republicans. It'll be 100 miles high. Have they never seen the Great Wall of China? No, but they know a big fence in Chicago. Do they not know the story of the Great Wall of China? That in fact, you can spend all your resources building the wall, but then the gatekeeper gives a copy of the key to the guy outside and the hordes come in anyway. And meanwhile, you have beggared your own economy building your stupid walls so that you can't afford to defend yourself when you actually are, you know, invaded. Nope. Never dawned on a Republican, because that would involve some thinking, and thinking is the last damn thing that Republicans do. It amazes me. But it is absolutely driving the Bush administration crazy that nobody else, with the exception of Israel, will get on our Jesus Christ, the Iranians are a bunch of mad, crazed of the killers bandwagon. So they want to make sure that, among other things, the Iranians and the Russians can't get all cozy and play footsie with each other, because after all, the former Soviet Union had a common border with Iran, then they've been known to be friendly. That's what this is about. If I can sit here in the hills and hollers of West by God, Virginia, and see that, you're telling me that the guys that get paid 6 and 7 figures a year can't? Of course they can. What they do, however, is when they see it, they look away from it and then try to cook up another damn lie to cover it. Ugh. Sorry, couldn't resist the vowel comment. How do you pronounce B-R-D-Y? Hell, Polynesian words are easier to pronounce. But that's me, and I'm crazy. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
They have definitely identified the body as that.
Deborah Jean Palfrey?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, when I first saw the story, I figured I'd see something like out of the end of To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, where Bob Ewell fell on his knife 32 times.
Uh-huh.
But now she hanged herself in some shed?
That's what I said, in her mother's.
Yeah.
Shed behind her mother's house.
You buying that?
Are you kidding?
Here's a woman sitting on enough information to hang every Republican from Maine to Spain and home to Rome. And she up and suddenly commits suicide.
Yeah. Seems like that. There's a lot of that going around, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's catching.
Especially if they've got something, somebody else doesn't know or whatever.
I'm sure at the end of the rope there's a little tag that says, "We're the Republican National Committee, and we approve this rope."
And they said she had 2 suicide notes. I'm not saying what
Well, one for formal and one for informal.
I guess.
Anybody know where David Vitter was?
He's probably living it up when he hears the news.
Oh, he'll... Hey, honey, it's okay.
But, you know, I heard her being interviewed, and she was sound like a very smart woman.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, not enough. The information was not allowed to get out at trial because, you know, let's say that wouldn't we all have loved to have known what it, because she always, she maintained all along that she was not running a sex service.
Yeah.
That this was stuff that was non-sexual, but money was changing hands, which immediately takes you to the, it, look, is it prostitution if David Vitter hires you to, not you, Juanita, if, let's do that, this is going to be difficult. If David Vitter hires a woman to diaper him and call him dirty names, is that prostitution?
I don't know. That's what they say some of it is.
But that's, you know, that always, that's what it sounded like Deborah Jean Palfrey was saying.
Uh-huh.
That she was sort of running a non-sexual feed your kink service.
Yeah. Well, they were trying to take away her property was the biggest deal about it. She was trying to fight for her property.
Yeah.
And that's where all the rigmarole started. At least that's what I heard her say, you know, when she was interviewed. But I wonder if they got all the information.
Well, isn't it interesting? I've got a link here that Peter Godbold sent me. This story broke today, and the Washington Post already has a several column inches story out in which, you know, they just went, oh, it was suicide.
Well, it wasn't that ironic how fast they found her guilty.
Oh, yeah.
It saved anybody from having to come and testify. You know, being forced to testify. Did you notice that?
Yeah, and, what the defense does is up to the defense, but why the defense decided to mail it in without at least getting a little bit of humiliation out of, I guess you're not allowed to do that, but...
Yeah,
I've got a note here from our pal Marty saying that Deborah Jean Palfrey was Ken Laid.
The what?
That he was Ken Laid. Remember Ken Laid? Just, you know,
certainly.
And now he's living off in Brazil, in the Brazilian rainforest with Elvis or something? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that there are some that are living in places like that. You know what I'm saying? They can't all be, but... There's so many coincidences, and you know, I heard years and years ago that the spies do have a secret place, like some island or something. Where
there's a guy in a white suit with a little short dude, and he's, "Welcome to Fantasy Island." No, I'm kidding. Yeah. I got to stop this. I'm in a strange place tonight, Juanita.
You're what?
I'm in a strange place tonight.
Really?
I don't know. My mind's just going six different ways from Sunday.
Oh, yeah. I can understand. And I'm sorry we didn't get to hear the program last night.
I am, too.
Yeah.
I was incredible.
Was anybody recording it?
Oh, I videoed it, and it's got some very poor audio. But the audio inside the facility was so screwed up, Juanita, that half the time the audience couldn't hear.
Wow.
It was very frustrating. And the folks, the women who run Seneca 2, were fit to be tied.
Yeah.
And so we've got David K. Johnston coming up in July, and I have told them, look, if I have to get down there a day earlier, we'll get this right.
Yeah.
And they said the same thing to me because...
Is that very far from where you live?
Modern gas prices, it was $60 from where I live.
Not close, in other words.
About $1 a mile. About 50 cents a mile. But about 60 miles from here. Down a narrow two-lane road, down a mountain, and through the Chemical Valley and out to the west of Charleston and to the university there.
Before I forget, I want to say something about those tests that Casey was talking about.
Sure.
The first, I believe it was the first year they had them down here for the seniors. A lot of the most smart of the seniors, a lot of them did not pass that test. And some of them even had scholarships, you know, for their I'm not able to talk correctly.
That's okay. It happens to me all the time.
Yeah. Anyway, for some reason I've been this way all day. But they didn't pass. They were the smartest students in school. They were honor students and all, biggest part of them, and they were the ones that didn't pass, and they weren't going to be able to go and take advantage of their scholarships. And I think Jeb just decided he might better let them have it. Yeah, it was the first year. But one reason I wanted to ask you is now they voted that in, and it immediately became the law of the whole country.
It's all part and parcel of No Child's Behind Left, but states administer it in different ways.
Well, what I'm wondering is that shouldn't have that been like trying to get an amendment to the Constitution where everybody had to vote on it instead of it?
It's just a federal law. It's just a federal law. Just like Congress passes any federal law.
Well, I've never heard of them having that, you know, and just it immediately becomes accepted and driving people crazy, students and teachers.
Well, at the point in time when it was passed, Juanita, George Bush was desperate for some sort of a domestic so-called victory. This was early in his first administration.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And they put together this bipartisan agreement that was brokered by Ted Kennedy, and they came out, oh, we reached across the aisle, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And it was one of those act in haste, repent in leisure pieces of legislation where nobody realized exactly what a screwed up mess that it was. I don't know who read it. It's probably like the Patriot Act, 476 pages that never got read.
Yeah.
Because, for instance, there was that little thing tucked into it that, to the best of my knowledge, has never been remedied, that says that any parent who doesn't want his child or her child recruited by the military has to openly opt out of it in writing. So you've got a right to, and they don't have a duty to tell you that you have that opportunity. That's inside the No Child's Behind Left Act. That allows the military to come into poor school systems, like the ones where my kids go, and prey upon them, and go and get more hamburger meat for George's grinder in the sand.
Right. Yeah. But I just wondered why that was all of a sudden it was the law of the land. You know,
I understand. Yeah, no, there's no doubt it got hustled through, but it's administered as a function of the Department of Education, and then it's imposed upon the several states, and the several states administer it in different fashions. That's part of why it was such a failure. The whole thing was based on the dummied up, ginned up, faked up, rubed up fraud that Bush's first education secretary.
Oh, yeah.
Remember him? Rod Page,
oh, yeah,
I think was his name.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He was from Houston. He'd done the Houston miracle. Oh, he transformed the Houston educational system. And it turned out it was all a sick joke.
Uh-huh. Well, it was really to make money for his brother.
Sure it was. There is a financial angle to every blessed thing that the Bush administration does.
Yep, you got that right.
And this was Marvin and Neil and that hateful old mother of theirs and their special education company, because they came up with all this crap for school systems to use to in turn teach the test.
Yeah.
And they made a fortune on it. They hustled it all over the place.
Well, they must be doing all kind of jigs of money that they make off of people. Nobody makes it off of them.
Oh, no. Well, that's why they're filthy rich.
Yeah.
The rich get rich by not paying taxes and by not spending money.
And you were talking about last night about that Hinckley boy that shot Reagan.
Yeah.
Actually, what I understand was that his brother was best friends with either Neil or the other one.
Oh, they're all
having meal together. Pardon?
Yeah, they're all buddied up all over the place.
Yeah.
And I knew there was some Bush that was having dinner with some Hinckley the day that.
Yeah, it was one of the brothers, besides Jeb. It was either Neil or the other one.
If America knew this stuff, Juanita, do you think they'd finally sit up and realize what a bunch of thugs the Bushes are?
It's just like it goes by. It doesn't even go in one ear and out the other. It's like it just goes by.
That's about the size of it.
And, if it went in one ear and out the other, maybe they would retain some of it. But it's like no matter what they do, it doesn't matter. No matter what they do. I just don't get it myself.
Neither do I, for the most part.
But it's not what I want, for our country.
I don't get it either, and that's part of the reason that I'm here for 3 hours a night just sort of trying to process through it myself, Juanita.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. Maybe one of these days we'll get it all sorted out.
I hope.
All right, Juanita, you have a wonderful evening, all right?
You too, and you take care, and you're a hillbilly. Elitist.
Darn right. Don't forget it either.
And it's proud to know you.
All right. Proud to know you too, Juanita. Bye now.
Okay. Good night.
I am indeed a hillbilly elitist. Let's see if we've got someone. Hi. Welcome to the program. Hello. Aw. Darn it. Sometimes those are right wingers. Sometimes it's people who just can't wait. Sometimes it's people who don't want to rack up tolls on the toll-free line. Sometimes it's a right-winger. You never know. You just never know. Oh, let's see. Let's wander it. No, let's see. Okay, we're trying again. All right. We will go back to the phones, and with any luck, we'll have somebody this time. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Bob.
Well, good morning, Robert.
Yes, of course.
Wonderful to hear from you.
You doing okay?
Yeah, pretty much, I guess.
Okay. I thought I'd just call to bring you up to some news on Japan and...
Oh, yes.
A little bit. The latest thing is the issue of, we got gas prices and a butter shortage now.
Butter? Oh, you might need to turn your speakers down in the background if you don't.
Oh, okay, sure. And that's the latest thing.
We got to investigate this, Robert.
Okay.
A butter shortage?
Butter shortage. Yeah, it's in the Mainichi Daily. Basically, the drought in Australia has pushed grain prices up in Australia, so there's also more demand from China. The Chinese are now eating butter. So,
we've managed to transfer more of our bad habits to Asia.
Yeah. Well, they said that if the Chinese ate one more egg, if all the Chinese ate one more egg per day, per week, it would wipe out the grain reserves of Australia. So that's how.
I don't have any problem believing that, but that kind of an economy of scale just blows my mind, Robert.
Yeah. think about it. I mean, just one egg per week. I mean, that's not getting to.
Were you still in country here a few years ago when the California Almond Board had that that campaign? All we ask you to do is eat one can a week.
No, I missed that one.
I just remember, you know, the California Almond Board, or maybe it was Blue Diamond Almonds, or one. Just eat one can a week. That's all we ask. We don't fully comprehend the power, and I'm not talking about nuclear power anymore. We don't fully comprehend the power of China, do we?
No, we don't. I mean, even Cuba has butter shortages now because the grain to feed the cows is not as much, and so they're reducing the number of cows to for milk supplies. And so this is not, I mean, I guess if you look at the coming shortages to come, the butter and the milk would go first. So I'm stocking up on my butter, and of course, you know, there's...
Well, it does freeze quite well.
Does it? Okay. Well, I'll keep that in mind, sir, because I've been stocking up a little bit, but not as much as I should.
And you know a trick you can do to make it a little bit more heart healthy? You can take that, of course, this is probably exquisitely expensive there, too, but you know that ultra-light olive oil that doesn't have the real profound olive oil taste?
Okay.
You can take a pound of butter and leave it out and sit till it comes to room temperature, and whip it with some olive oil.
Okay.
And put it in a tub or whatever with a lid on it, and let it re-solidify. Mm-hmm. And you've made a very nice little heart healthy addition to your butter usage.
Oh, okay. I'll keep that in mind. So yeah, we've escaped the rice shortages in other countries for some reason, but.
Does Japan grow its own most of its own rice?
Yeah, yes, and it's well subsidized. I mean, we pay about $17 for a 5-kilo bag. So,
I'm sorry, I'm making the conversion. So that's about 22 pounds.
Yeah, well, let me see. Well, 5 kilos is about 12 pounds, right? 13 pounds, maybe.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. I thought, right. Yeah, 2.2 pounds to the kilo.
Right. So 5 kilos and about 12, 13 pounds for $17. Yeah. So, but, and then gas prices, we had a little 1 month break for gas prices. We had a nice, because the gas tax, the federal gas tax, ended after 30 years and the parties couldn't agree to continue it. It was enacted 30 years ago to get the roads built. So all the roads are built, and so after 30 years it had finished. And so our gas prices went down about 30 cents roughly per liter, per quart roughly, and so we had cheap gasoline for a change, $4.84 a gallon.
Yeah. Well, we'll be there soon, Robert. We'll be there soon.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
But the Japan. But again, please, the Japanese people got something out of it.
Yeah, we got roads. Yeah, that's true.
And now it kind of blows my mind because it always struck me that. It's as expensive to maintain roads as it is to build them, just about.
Yeah.
So once the how's it? But I'm sure there are smarter people than me thinking about stuff like that. But you did get some. You know, we have never gotten anything practically out of our gas taxes, and whether they're gas taxes in Japan or gas taxes in Australia or gas taxes in the United States, they're all regressive because they affect poorer drivers more than they affect the wealthier drivers because it represents a higher percentage of disposable income.
Well, I mean, I think what has happened over the past 5 or 10 years, probably, I mean, when all the roads were built and the money just went to the politicians or to the construction companies, which then gave, you know, favors and contributions to their favorite politicians that would continue, you know, funding their construction companies. And so that's pretty much where it went. Pretty much like in the United States, you know, where the taxes go to the, you know, subsidies of corporations. The corporations fund Republicans. So you know how that all works. But no, that all the gas tax was reinstated. This morning, actually. I was wondering what all the lines were at the gas stations for last night because I didn't keep up with it. So now we got about $6.24 a gallon now.
And so you're actually a couple of steps backwards from where you were before the tax
yeah.
was.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I mean, this is probably going to be the one that really kills the conservative party, which is, you know, ironically named the Liberal Democratic Party, because a lot of people were, you know, once they had, you know, a little taste of cheap gasoline at $4.84, and then it's back up to where it was and beyond, you know, I don't see them getting much in the way of people support, but. It was bizarre because once they lowered the gas prices down, the gas stations refused to post the prices. And so you just got all these white blanks where the prices were supposed to be because they didn't want the people to know how much they were keeping until you got up at the pump and asked. So it was real bizarre. Go ahead.
No, you know, the Japanese have as great a love affair, or if not greater, with their automobiles than the American people do. And they also do a heck of a lot better job manifesting it in the care that they take of their vehicles, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, used cars are great.
And so, what's this going to do? What's this going to do to Japanese commuter culture?
Well, I mean, it's a lot of people. I mean, especially the people that drive motorcycles for fun. Everyone's complaining about it, and they're all very upset about it. I guess the situation was, you know, that I had been paying $6.24 for, well, since I've been driving. So that's been driving here maybe about 12 years. And so you get used to it. It's like, you know, blink an eye. So it's very common. I mean, don't be surprised when Americans pull up at the gas pump and gas is $5 or $5.50 a gallon and they don't blink an eye.
Well, see, that's what I've been saying all along. Because everybody says, well, you know, there's got to be a break point. There's got to be a place where the American people won't tolerate it anymore. What are they going to do? Pour the tea into pour the gasoline into Boston Harbor?
Right, right. Or walk, you know. I mean, no, that's not going to happen. So
we are well and truly over a barrel in this country. And
you have no idea.
So too with other you know, highly automobile dependent countries, so-called first world countries, we're just the rubes, Robert.
Mm.
You know, we're the stupid Johns that keep paying the money.
Mm.
And because, like I've said before, here where I am in West Virginia, I can't. I physically, literally cannot go to an automobile-less way of living. Now, it's, on the one hand, you could say, "Yeah, but what about your forebears? They got along without cars. They had horses and wagons."
Right.
I don't have a horse. I don't have a wagon. I got two legs. And the grocery store is 6 miles up and 6 miles back on a road that's full of coal trucks. The
right.
Odds aren't good. And that's not just here. That's all over West Virginia. That's all over rural America because our general stores are gone. The little neighborhood mom and pops are gone.
Mm.
The new McMansion communities that get built are built as far as they can possibly be away from commerce, and then they zone the property so that there can't be a little mom and pop corner store that sells canned milk and bread and a six pack of beer and some smokes or Kool-Aid or whatever.
Mm.
Maybe it happened by accident, but a whole hell of a lot of it to me, Robert, looks like design.
Well, when they keep increasing the prices, you know, bit by bit, you slowly get used to it. And I just noticed today Exxon's profits had soared again.
Well, they kind of soared. Did you catch the tail end of the story?
No, I didn't.
Well, ExxonMobil reported profits that were insanely high, as is always the case lately, but they weren't insanely high enough.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. No, not close to expectations, yeah, I saw that.
And as a result of that, the Rockefeller family dropped the hammer on the Exxon board of directors.
Mm.
Not kidding. The story I've got here says, the descendants of John D. Rockefeller, the legendary oil man who started Exxon's predecessor, Standard Oil, are agitating for the board to split the chairman and chief executive role while attacking the world's largest stock-quoted oil company for failing to take environmental issues seriously enough. Okay, I'll buy all of that.
Okay.
But the firestorm started based on these diminished profit numbers. They're not profiting insanely enough to suit the Rockefellers.
Okay. I knew there had to be a punchline in there somewhere. Oh, how amusing. How amusing.
And, oh, by the way, you know what they blamed the diminished numbers on?
What?
The $10.9 billion net income figure was bolstered by a 70% increase in U.S. crude prices.
Mm.
But Exxon's oil output was cut, and here's the blame part, after some of its assets were seized by that nasty, nasty communist Hugo Chavez.
Oh, it gets funnier and funnier, doesn't it?
So you know the phone somewhere gets picked up at Exxon headquarters, right. And it rings on the desk of George Bush.
Right.
And it's, George? George? This was not part of the deal, George. When are you sending the jets to Venezuela?
Right, right.
And you know, all this stuff about Iran. Wouldn't it... Can you try to crawl around inside that really, really nasty, verminous space between Dick Cheney's ears for a couple of minutes, Robert, and think about it. Can you imagine how he feels when he thinks, okay, we've got hold of Iraq's oil... We're in good terms with the Saudis. Now all we need is Iran's. And we've got it all. Tell me that doesn't go through his head.
Of course, of course. I mean, they got to prop up the dollar somehow, you know. And this is my other little beef for the day is the idea of competing currencies and it's the complete insanity of it all, because here in Japan, you have a culture where the people are not corrupt. They work very, very hard, too hard. They're honest. They're good. And so everyone loves to buy the yen. It's a good value for the money. And so, but the problem with that is if the yen goes up, the people, the exporters can't export because the products are too expensive.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
And so if you can't export anything, you don't have factories with workers in them because, you know, you have to close the factory because your product is too expensive. So you, in order to export anything, you have to trash your currency. You have to make it as cheap as possible. And so that's what the Japanese have done. They have, bless their little hearts, tried to trash their currency in as much as possible because they can't do war, so they're prevented from doing that. So we've had... all manners of stupidity. I mean, roads to nowhere. We have more asphalt than the United States has, concrete. We have hillsides that are, you know, concreted up to prevent any kind of landslides. We have huge tetrapods, you know, the ones that you put on beaches to prevent sand erosion.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, these are really huge little mothers, but we've almost got the entire island ringed with them. And I think each one probably would cost maybe about $10,000. And, with making them and transporting them and loading them and placing them, at least minimum figure. And so Japan's debt is 110% of its GNP, which I think is a record. I mean, its debt ratio is just above Malawi's, I think, in Africa. And by doing that, it's able to then lower its value of its currency to the point where they can then export something. Like Toyotas and stuff.
Well, what then? We used to hear years ago, Robert, about the fact that the Japanese had one of the highest savings rates of any country in the world, where the Japanese people...
That was the other problem. That was the other problem. That's what kept driving the yen up and up and up, because, oh, you have all this money. But now the younger people are, you know, they're in a situation where they don't have that lifetime job. They don't have full-time jobs with bonuses and stuff. And we have almost a subculture called NEETS, N-E-E-T-S, or FREETS, which basically are people that are part-time workers, and that's the only thing they're ever going to have for their entire lives. And so most young people don't have money. They're in debt. And they also have these huge desires. So I see people with huge vans now and big spanking mortgages. And then Koizumi, who was, you know, Bush's man, his first priority was to privatize the post office, which had, which we, here in Japan, we, you can pay your electric bill, your water bill there, and you can also open up an insurance account and also savings account.
It was almost like a currency exchange.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was probably the largest bank in the world, basically, in terms of actual, or one of the largest, I don't know, in terms of actual how much money was actually at the post office. So it was very convenient, because, you know, it's right there, and you go to the post office often. But Kazumi was hell-bent on privatizing it, which he was able to do, and so now the Western investors have access to that money. So where that money's going now, I don't know. Off to the person with the highest interest rate, perhaps. So Citibank borrows it for 3%, and then Citibank gives it to someone else who offers 4% and 5%, 6%. So the biggest clown that offers the highest interest rate, which probably doesn't have much credibility, gets all that money, pretty much like the subprime.
It's a game of global currency old maid.
Yeah, it's the Ponzi scheme. You know, it's a Ponzi scheme of incredible dimensions. And so, I mean, that's pretty much where, you know, Japan's at right now. We've had to trash its currency. The United States is doing that. I think that's one of the purposes of the war, was to lower the value of the dollar so we can compete with China. Stupid. I mean, it's insane. And then you have interest rates as well. I mean, look at the United States. You know, it's lowering the value of the dollar, so the dollar plummets, and then you have stupid things like European farmers buying 40% of the wheat supply in the United States because it's cheaper than European wheat. And so you have price of bread that's skyrocketing in the United States now because of the weak dollar. And the weaker, I mean, the lower it goes, it's going to be less and less bread for y'all.
Yeah, it is, and I don't know where it ends. You know, you mentioned interest rates. You know, the Fed cut it by another quarter point yesterday, and they said, oh, honest to God, this is the last time we're going to do it. Really, this is the last interest rate cut. And I'm sorry, I've known too many drunks and drug addicts in my time to believe that when they look at me and say, oh, I'm done with it. No, I'm not. Because, you know, I know I'm going to find the chairman of the Fed over in the corner contemplating another 0.25% cut in another month and a half.
Sure enough. And, I mean, and it's going to be the lower dollar. Anytime the dollar goes down, the Saudis say, well, we're not taking this. You know, this way will reduce our revenue, so we have to increase gas prices. And so, bam, bam, bam. So, I mean, I saw on the BBC a very interesting show maybe 2 years ago about alternatives to money. Did you ever see that one?
No.
One was in England, which they had a time bank. Now, this was, you know, the time bank is where you put in an hour of time, and then you get an hour of time from somebody else. So, in other words, if the janitor puts in 1 hour of time, he can go to the doctor and get 1 hour of time. It's all equal. And so, and that's how some people get around. So they put in an hour of time, and this way it's not devalued, it's not inflated, it's not, you know, it's pretty stable. It's very stable currency. Another one was just down south of where I'm at, maybe about 3 hours, in a Japanese city called Yufuin, which is a beautiful resort town. And what they have is that in August, when everyone's free, most people are free, everyone floods down, so the city's filled with cash. But after September, October, there's nobody there, no more tourists, and they're starving. And so what they just decided to do is to form a local currency, in which you, if again, same principle where you put in so much time, you get so much credit, and then you take that credit to get your clothes cleaned or whatever. So the local economy is then kept alive during this drought period of no tourists. So, and then they named about five other alternatives to, you know, actual currency, which I think is important in the times where you have your currency being either inflated or devalued. So,
and ultimately, the people who are hit by inflated or devalued currency, you know, it's not gonna hit the people who are borrowing by the billion.
Right. Of course not. No, they're not concerned about it. I mean,
no, it's somebody who can't afford to have, like you said, their clothes cleaned.
Right. So, Now, I guess if you put into the search network like alternatives to money, you probably will get a link or so that's, you know, very interesting to look at. Maybe, you know.
And it's not that different. I'm on this kick right now where I'm trying to persuade my 14-year-old when she's done reading her vampire books to pick up To Kill a Mockingbird. And anybody who's ever read that book knows the portion of the story where Mr. Cunningham brings the bag of hickory nuts to Atticus Finch because that's how he's paying him off for helping him with his entailment.
Okay,
it is not an idea that is foreign to the United States. It's an idea that's been made foreign by virtue of the machinations of the currency manipulators, but barter is as old as the hills.
Well, I mean that it's a great way, but also you avoid taxes. You know, there's no way that the IRS can tax a trade. And you remember when Oprah Winfrey gave out those cars?
Yeah, the Pontiac. Yeah.
And then some Republican was watching it, and bam, he notified the IRS, and so. Those women that got the cars, they would have to pay, I think, $9,000 on, or I don't know, it was about $4,000, because it's a gift, and so it's like winning the lottery, and so that kind of money is taxed at a very high rate, like 45%. And so all the women pretty much lost their cars. And so the way to get around that situation is to say, okay, women, there is a potato under your chair. Get your potato. Okay, now take it up to the man and trade your potato for your car. And you do the trade and you show it on TV, and there's not that damn thing the IRS could do.
Couldn't the IRS complain that it was a fraudulent transaction insofar as there was not,
What? I mean, if I want to trade a car for a potato, I mean, what's the big deal? I mean,
well, no, free market economics would dictate that.
Right.
On the other hand, the potato was a gift. I'm thinking like an IRS bureaucrat does, because you know one of the
you buy your potato, you know, plump down 30 cents for your potato.
Then you bring it to the studio.
Right.
One of the things you learn in contracts class is that every contract must have consideration. Which is, you know, I'm giving you something for something, but that the court will never inquire into the sufficiency of consideration or entertain a complaint based upon the sufficiency of the consideration, unless there is active proof of fraud.
Mm.
And that's fraud, and that would be, you know, fraud in the inducement or something.
Yeah, I get.
But no, I get what you're going at, and you know what? I'd forgotten that it was some sort of little spoil sport. Who saw it on TV, who spoiled it for everybody. I'd forgotten that part.
Right. So, no, I mean, if you look at the situation, I mean, people got to realize that their savings accounts really are, it's kind of iffy. I mean, with the dollar dropping, you know, your $30,000 can become $3,000. I mean, you know, it may take a year or so, but, or 2 years, but, and,
But if they leave it alone, isn't there just as great a likelihood that its value will rebound?
Over time. I mean, yeah, if we get the Democratic, you know, responsible leaders in there. But I just don't like the whole idea of where we have to compete against each other downwards, you know?
Well, and that's precisely it. I saw a article today from some right winger complaining that, you know, the Democrats in the Congress are turning the Colombia Free Trade Agreement into a political football when the Colombia Free Trade Agreement will benefit all Americans by making Colombian products cheaper in America and American products easier for Colombians to purchase.
Bull.
Because again, it's what you just said, Robert. It's the shameful race to the bottom.
Yep.
It's the direct antithesis of everything that we've ever been taught about, you know, well, if you work hard and you never give up and you climb the ladder and you you've got to be willing to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Well, you know, these free trade agreements, among other things, that's not pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. That's taking your boots off and throwing them away and walking on the hot coals by choice.
It only benefits a few companies, and that's about it.
It's going to benefit the companies, and it'll benefit the governmental, because, you know, Colombia is the last friend we have in South America.
Right, exactly.
And so we will prop up the fascist dictatorship of Uribe there, and the free trade agreement will empower thugs who go around putting two bullets in the back of the heads of union organizers. Now, meanwhile, if you get them all liquored up in a room somewhere and they think nobody's listening, a Republican, American Republican congressman will say, two bullets in the back of the head of a union organizer? What the hell's wrong with that?
Yeah, yeah.
Because they like that kind of stuff. Because the peasants in Colombia or Peru or Mexico or anywhere else that we have these free trade agreements, the peasants stay peasants because of what you've been talking about with the monkeying around with the monetary values.
Well, I mean, it becomes almost like a kabuki play where you watch all this and you actually wonder what the hell is going on. And even with Obama, I mean, what, 2 months ago, he sends one of his secret, one of his representatives to Canada to say, don't worry about, you know, NAFCO. We got it all under wraps, Dave. We're just into the con. And, what's that all about? And his advisors from the University of Chicago Business School, which is a fascist free market university.
Yeah, really mean people.
Yeah, and that's his economic advisor. I mean, either he doesn't have any common sense about choosing his own economic advisor, or it was appointed to him, or that's what he really thinks.
I gotta think that this free trade stuff, if you're, you know, if you're measuring your net worth in seven digits, it probably is pretty seductive stuff. Because it looks from that, I mean, it's like the difference between looking at a garbage dump at eye level and looking at a garbage dump from 20,000 feet up. At 20,000 feet, a garbage dump looks like modern art. It's the same thing with these free trade agreements. You know, they seduced Bill Clinton with it, and Bill Clinton grew up poor.
Yeah.
And they've seduced Barack Obama with it, and guess what? They've seduced Hillary with it and McCain. I don't know, it's like some sort of Lodge High sign. Oh, you're rich now, it's time to talk about free trade. Well, what about the poor people? Screw the poor people.
Screw
I'm not you know how I feel about organized labor. I love the labor movement. Okay, I adore it. I'm sitting here with a reasonably halfway decent state college education because of the labor movement. But I know for a fact that there are labor people out there who, if you mention issues relating to poverty to them, will say, screw the poor, I'm not in the business of helping the poor, I don't care about the poor. Okay, so, and it's all proportional to salary.
Well, I think that's why we need a worldwide minimum wage and worldwide interest rates and a worldwide, kind of a currency, I guess.
Oh, God, Robert, don't let the fundies hear you say that. He's one of them one-world government. He's probably the Antichrist himself.
That's right, So, because the competition I don't see any way out of this mess, As long as you got this competing currency and the dollar's dropping, and in order to have it not drop, you have to raise taxes and then you have to raise the interest rates. And so the Democrats aren't going to do that. The Republicans aren't sure as hell ain't going to do it. So, and then each time the dollar drops, it's brass knuckles on the face of the poor, because the gas prices go up and the food prices go up. And
yeah, and the chairman of the Fed's over there in the corner with a calculator, the way you'd expect to see a kid with a crack pipe.
Yep.
Yeah, half a percent. Come on, just a half a percent, please.
Half a percent, so
they're running out of percents.
Well, I mean, it's like in Japan, we're down to 0.2%, and we've been here at this for about since I've been here, longer than I've been here, so probably what, 20 odd years, I don't know, more, and for past 14 odd years, it's been in a recession. I mean, a couple of years we had a good, it's okay. But,
But people are still out there. They're going to the ballparks and they're driving their cars and they're not in the streets, and they're not, it's not like a student protest in Seoul or anything.
No.
The Japanese people are as seduced as the Americans, aren't they, Robert?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's been bred out of them through the school system and all, but.
Well, now see, there's a question. Was it?
Okay.
And I'm not trying to be bigoted here. Call me on it if I am.
Okay.
But in Japanese culture, was it ever in them to be bred out?
Yes and no. I mean, there was a time in which 150 years ago, the Japanese were pretty wild, and it was not the image that a lot of people have. But there was a lot of central control with the shoguns and stuff. And so on a national level, yeah, you could say that they've always been well-controlled and all, but on a personal and local level, maybe not so. And it depends on the city, too. I mean, Osaka, people in Osaka have always been pretty wild and, you know, in your face. Kyushu, you're pretty direct, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to describe a whole, group of people. But, if you get rid of critical thinking and stuff like that in the school system, yeah, you don't have critical thinkers. I mean, that's one aspect. That's why I've actually written textbooks and used them with my own students to put that back into them. So,
and when you do that, just out of curiosity, Robert, when you do that, do you like time travel and go back to the pre-Socratics and the Socratics and the Aristotelian models and stuff like that, or do you have to use some sort of other paradigm?
So I use another paradigm, which is different kinds of critical thinking, like analysis, conjecture, a whole different model. So each different chapter is focused on a different critical thinking aspect. But I found that students have a hard time just coming up with opinions, their own opinions. I mean, it's that bad. So, if you have an education system focused on that for the past 30 years, you shouldn't be surprised. So
do you get students coming back to you a couple of years later and saying, Professor Robert, I really appreciate what you did for me, or I found out it's different out there, or I see the world differently, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, they always remember me, which I'm always kind of surprised, because I'm just one of a small line of teachers with the 4 years. So, one of my aspects is not to have my students just learn English, but to be able to say something intelligent in English, no sense of having a fluent fool, basically. We got enough of those in.
Lord God, you are a rarity, Robert.
Well, it's important to have something to say, and just being able to say something. Because I said, even if you become fluent and you have nothing to say, it's kind of pointless, isn't it?
Yeah, well, exactly. I was joking with our good buddy Ben Birch yesterday. I said, and we were talking about places that might be pleasant to live, and he mentioned Germany, and I said, yeah, I can say Wo ist das Biergarten, and I'm pretty good. I'm good to go at that point. Where's the beer joint? Joking, and he said, yeah, vos der, die, and das, it's misery. Right. Vos de Bahnhof, where's the railroad station? Where's the beer? get me to the greengrocer. But what you say is so very, very true. It's important to have something to say.
Okay.
And Lord, isn't that the very heart and soul of what we're about here?
It is so pitiful for people to go their entire lifetimes just with banal conversation. And some people do, or superficial thinking. And to me, that is just a wasted life.
Well, I asked you a few minutes ago about the pre-Socratics, the Socratics, and all of that stuff. And, I think about that line from Plato that the unexamined life is not worth living.
Yeah. Well, I'm finally going through an old philosophy textbook, I think university level. Because I never had any of that in high school. When I grew up in the 60s and 70s, I'm 48, a couple of years older than you. No philosophy at all. And did you get any in high school or college?
I got a good bit in college, and I had to fight to get it because my advisor was saying, but that's not, you've already filled out that part of your core. I said, screw my core, I'm here to learn.
Right.
Well,
it's almost de-emphasized. I mean,
it absolutely is. and engineers go through engineering school and they take English 101 and English 102 and they're done with the language.
Mm.
When if anybody needs to be able to express profound concepts, you would think it would be an engineering student, but no.
Yeah, exactly.
I've talked, our friend Cassie, I've talked with her in the past about choosing curriculum and stuff, not that I'm advising or anything like that, but she says, you know, I want to be a journalist. And at one point I said, then please go somewhere that has a really rotten journalism school.
Mm. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Because the less journalism you get,
right,
the better journalist you're likely to be.
Hello, right, exactly.
I know somebody...
Clap.
Yeah, I know somebody around here who has 3 master's degrees in education,
mm-hmm,
and couldn't tell you the first thing about educating human beings.
Mm.
Because they don't know anything, Robert. They know, right, educational theory. They don't know, I had a conversation because I took Ferg with me yesterday as we went down for the abortive broadcast attempt. I took him down with me and we were talking along the way and I said, you've seen Steve Martin in some movies and stuff, right? Because we were talking about learning and reading, yeah, and things like that. And he says, yeah. I said, you think he's funny, right? Yeah. I said, guess where he learned to be funny, Ferg? And he said, where? And I said, when he was in college, he majored in philosophy.
Wow.
And he said, what's that got to do with it? I said, he spent his academic life learning the ways by which people learn and think about things. And when you learn how people's minds work, you can learn how to make their mind think something is funny. And so we had one of those jaw drop kind of father son moments, and you know, those are really cool. But there's so much truth in that. You know, we don't teach the liberal arts. I guess it's because David Horowitz would put you on some sort of a list. Oh, he's a liberal arts professor. That must mean he hates Jesus. You know, that kind of stuff. Oh God, I get so sick of it, Robert.
Okay, well, I got to get off to work, dude.
All right, a way to work with you, and our absolute best to your students. And I tell you what, I think they're in good hands.
Okay.
All right, take care, Robert.
In good hands with you too.
All right, bye now.
Okay, bye bye.
I love my conversations with Robert, and the idea that I can sit here on a hilltop in West Virginia and talk to a guy who's getting ready to go and teach a class in Japan. I'm sorry, I'm real simple that way. Let's see if anybody's hung on. Hi, welcome to the Hey, what's up, David?
Yeah, well, I just decided to call in and talk about a few stories and give some people some reality to think about. Hopefully,
hold on a minute.
But
we deal in reality here. Give people
reality. Some serious reality of where the kids are headed. Not the people, the kids.
Okay.
What do you think the number one... the number one profit for the company is going to be this week? The number one thing. Is it going to be a movie? Is it going to be a DVD? Is it going to be a toy? What's it going to be? What do you think?
It's May. We're not at summer movie season yet. I'm thinking it's a DVD release.
I'm about to blow your minds, people. This is where we're at. Rockstar Games is about to break the record right now as we speak with their Grand Theft Auto 4, $350 million the first week.
Jesus, yeah, I saw that advertised. I've seen banner ads of some CGI-generated, scantily clad woman with lips the size of the Krispy Kreme donuts.
Right. While people are starving in the streets, we got kids probably, you know what, probably seriously, a lot of these sales... I wouldn't doubt if a lot of these are stolen and they're just counting them up.
God.
And also, I think that I don't know if you heard about this.
Now wait, like before we move on away from Grand Theft Auto 4.
Yes.
Do we already have advance warning of how many different scenes there are with naked pixelated women?
I don't know, but they will probably put them in the game, and they'll probably put them, in a backdoor situation where Well, we didn't mean to do that. That was some programmer to stir up controversy. Rockstar Games is probably one of the most clever game companies.
I was going to say, quite savvy. So, therefore, we have to start the clock ticking on the Hillary and the right-wing hissy mode, or hissy clock, for when she decides to introduce legislation to protect our children from dirty video games.
Well, you know, that's interesting you bring that up, because guess who jumped out before what Hillary was saying?
What? Who?
And who got the headlines? Well, Barack did. And he said, this game has a negative influence on our kids in this country. And it's almost like he's taking the bait. All you're doing, Barack, is you're just promoting a spike.
And do we wonder why I'm going to go to the voting booth on primary and election day with this sort of sheepish look on my face, David?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's this problem where we really need to have a school. I'm serious about this, Bob. We need to have a school on where the elite learn what it's like to be a citizen in this country, a ordinary citizen or a casual civilian, whatever you want to call it, a pleb, whatever. And any type of person who's a dweller. How about that? A suburban dweller.
A sort of a Mark Twain Prince and the Pauper sort of seminar.
Different kind of classes for that. And, I do think, we seriously need
Wouldn't you love to hand the caviar and canapé crowd a brick of ramen noodles and say, hey, guys, poor people eat this. And watch some Rockefeller peel the thing open and try to gnaw on the dry brick of ramen noodles. Wouldn't that be fun?
You know, I think there is a problem with the fact that a lot of people are too timid and they don't speak out, and they should. You know what they should do next time the news media goes by, and they're doing a casual news piece, and they're just Put some thought into it and put some aggression into it about none of these candidates understand of what it's like to be.
That's what I've been saying for months, David.
I know.
I don't see a white woman, a white guy, and a black guy. I see 3 millionaires.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's the same thing, and I'm shifting gears now, but but before I do that, a little fun fact for people. The number one world record violinist, Vanessa May, has a net worth of $64 million, and she plays the violin, and it's the world record, and she's only 28. So
you know what? I'm okay with a multimillionaire violinist. That beats the hell out of being a multimillionaire ultimate fighting champion.
Yeah.
Because it is comparative, and there's some work that went into that. You know, I'm one of these geeks that goes across the channels, and I see the little 14-year-old ice skating nymph who has been basically cheated out of puberty because she's been got up at the crack of dawn since she was 2 years old. Honey, we're not going to learn to walk first. We're going to learn to skate. You know, or the gymnasts who are old women in their sport by the time they're 15. And I'm thinking, you know what? I hope there's some kind of a life forum out there.
Yeah.
Because they've damn sure been cheated out of a childhood. There's a lot of work that goes into that stuff. There's not a lot of work that goes... I mean, oh, who can I think of that I really hate the idea that they're insanely wealthy? Rush Limbaugh. There's one. Because all you've got to do is lie every day of your life. And that gets you $29 million a year. Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah.
Janet Parsall, Neil Bortz. They're all of them insanely wealthy for doing absolutely nothing.
Well, I just thought I'd put that not as a criticism or anything.
No. I get it. Yeah. And of course, backing up.
By the way, her albums are hard, but that's besides the point.
Well, what do you mean?
I mean, you know, the company says, hey, play this. Now play it like this. Now play that. Now do this. Now do that. I mean, there's not really any creative spirit to it. And she tries to do it for attention. Like on one of her album covers, she has the big problem was one of her she was going for attention, so she actually wore a white T-shirt that was wet on the cover. She's getting people interested in the contemporary side of violin, but you know, I don't know.
It sounds like silverware thrown on pavement, sort of atonal, sort of the jazz stuff that I don't get when.
It's really classical. She's the Madonna of classical music.
But it's played like a machine played it.
Well, you know, I mean, you know what it's like. I'll tell you, you hear one Yanni album and you don't want to hear the whole thing. You struggle to hear.
Zamfir, king of the pan flute.
Yeah. Well, the other story, I want to give people a good story, and nobody's talking about this, so I thought I'd bring it up. There's a guy named Terry Kenny, and he's found turn big truck traffic into electricity. And he says, while the Japanese are trying to produce electricity from station gates, entrepreneur Terry Kenny is going after a bigger target, trucks. It took him 8 years to get a working prototype, but now there's one working at the Port of Oakland, which Kenny calls the Dragon Power Station. Special plates are set on the road, and his big trucks drive over them, about 2,500 of them per day at the port. They compress a tank of hydraulic fluid under the road, which in turn creates a series of pumping actions that turns a generator to produce electricity. Of course, there's no such thing as a free lunch. The energy actually comes from the fossil fuels burned by the trucks. The benefit of that system is that they are harnessing energy that would otherwise be lost and doing so in a way that isn't noticeable in practice to the thousands of trucks. You see, it's ideas like that, the unorthodox practice that's going to get us to the next revolution. And we can't listen to what people say of it's not going to work, because electricity would be here if people said it's not going to work. We can't supply ourselves with that. We're not sure.
In Philadelphia 300 years ago or whatever, they were standing, or 250, whatever, people standing outside doing that. Damn fool Franklin's out there flying his kite in another electrical storm. You know, he's going to get fried one of these days. Don't know why he wants to play with that stuff. I don't know what he's trying to prove. Whale oil is good for America, good for the colonies. Whaling is, you know, the same thing that we say about coal.
Yeah.
You know, in any transitional period, David, there's the people who are getting left behind scream the loudest. The buggy whip manufacturers hated Henry Ford more than anybody else on earth because you didn't need to whip a car.
You know, the problem, and I see this on like places like Dig.com and the blogs, people are so trained as a whiplash reaction without actually knowing anything, without actually doing the research. And we're talking about smart, educated people. I'm not going to, stereotype a lot of bloggers on a lot of these tech sites. They get the same reaction, Bob. They're like, we can't harness the United States with that much power. We're not able to just supply that. I don't even know how you to do that. That's some tinfoil stuff right there.
Well, what have I heard John Fox say a million times? 100 square mile area in a piece of unused American desert with solar thermal generation would power the American electricity grid. It just would.
You know, I tend to agree with that, and
we could be awash in electricity. We could just walk around leaving the bulbs on all over the house all the time. We could keep our houses at 60 degrees in summer and 90 degrees in winter, if we wanted to, and eventually do it without harming the planet.
Well, I just wanted to mention that story. You guys can check it out.
That's a cool idea. It makes perfect sense.
You guys can check it out at treehugger.com, and there are pictures to show what this Dragon Power Station looks like, and it's really interesting. And the other thing I wanted to mention was, you know, Bob from North Dakota is really a sage. You know that?
Yes, I know.
He really is, because remember when he was talking that story about the Earth is losing dirt?
Yeah.
The topsoil? He was giving us that essay and that speech.
Yeah, he wasn't kidding.
What is that?
He wasn't kidding. Where he lives, they know. I mean, because it's topsoil is everything.
There's a story on DETnews.com you guys can check out. It's about the nutrient-rich topsoil being eroded much faster than it can be replenished. And it goes into detail about what Bob was saying about dust bowls and different things. And it's not that long. It's a interesting read. So if you go to DET News. And then one last thing before I go, because you probably have other people in line. You might want to suggest this to watch this movie with Ferg. It's called Son of Rambone. And
I saw that. I don't mean the movie. I saw a mention of it.
Yeah, and it's really an interesting movie because what it does is I think the poster is kind of misleading because it makes it look like a kid movie about Rambo or some kind of thing like Tim Allen, the Jungle Boy or something similar to that, on that kind of thing. So
yep.
The poster is kind of misleading in that respect. But really what the movie is about is it takes place where a kid is growing up a sheltered life in a religious cult, and he finds this rich latchkey kid who shows him the ways of making home movies from the inspiration of Rambo. And they decide to enter a contest, and all through England, the whole place it's set in England because it's a British movie, and he finds his way, and he has to be confronted with what he was taught with his religious ways of not being afraid of things that he's interested in, and standing up to people in this cult or called the Brethren. And it's an interesting little film, and it's great for kids, and it's funny too. It's well written, and it has a good ending. So I recommend Son of Rambo.
Very good. David, thanks a million.
No problem.
All right.
Later.
Later. Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hey there, Bob.
Hey, Luke.
Well, did you enjoy the Media Matters story on Tweety Bird?
Yeah, well, you know, to the extent that I enjoy anything that involves his name, but yeah.
But, you know, that's one of those nice little stories that that goes along nicely with the Mission Accomplished story. Because, you know, you've heard, though, the last couple of years how Tweety Bird's tried to reinvent his own history.
Sure.
You know, he was against the war. He was the one person at MSNBC against the war. You know, that's what he says now.
Where'd they get that? I mean,
people are turning against it. So all of a sudden, well, you all have to forget that I was a cheerleader for George Bush. So instead, I'll tell you, I was doing exactly what some fella, who I can't remember his name, named Donahue was doing.
Yeah, I know.
It's amazing how he was the one person. That
yeah, because Donahue got ditched because he was such a war cheerleader. He was such a hawk.
You know, it's one of those things. You know, when you go back and you look at the things and you start remembering things, it's amazing all the things we've forgotten in these last few years. Let's see, we had the statue pull down. I call it the rubber turkey run. The one I loved before the war when we found out that, oh, by the way, the U.S. was wiretapping the U.N.
Jesus.
Talk about five, it's like, well, gee, well, why were we wiretapping the U.N.?
Yeah, because after all, George said they were irrelevant anyway. Why do you need to wiretap something that's irrelevant?
Then you look at the way they manipulated the media, you know, the Dick Cheney shoots friend in face. Everybody says, okay, no problem. I still always love, the best one I love is the one with Lewis Black where he tries to explain it. You know, where he says, you know, you're always in a line. He said, there's not one person way out in front. He said, so how do you shoot somebody standing beside you when you're facing forward? He said, for some reason, Dick Cheney turned 90 degrees and decided to fire?
I know.
What was the one? One I'd forgotten about. I was reading something a few minutes ago. Remember interview with the kids, the Army kids over in Iraq, where we find out where they showed the one where they'd already rehearsed all the answers? Remember when he did? He did the teleconference.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And unfortunately, they put out the practice session on the air. You know, when they were practicing it, and then all of a sudden, later on had Bush come in there and do the exact same questions. You know, with no change.
You exactly. It goes on and on and on.
Well, I was sitting reading some of the stuff on it. I remember some of the people, you know, that think of what they've done over the years. Think of Wen-Ho Lee. You know, throw him in jail for a year for doing nothing. You know. Oh, by the way, we finally had a hearing. And by the way, we found out you didn't do it.
Yeah, never mind.
Just because
our bad.
Just because we were feeding false information to the press, so what? Or what was the captain's name? James Yee. Remember who the interpreter?
Yep, yep, yep. The dangerous Muslim chaplain.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Oh, my favorite still has to be our friend Jeff Gannon Guckert, whatever.
Yeah, Jimmy Jeff Ganny Guck.
Uh huh. And the Talon News Service.
Hi.
I'm Jeff Gannon,
Talon News.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I still want somebody to ever explain to me what he was doing there on all those days when there weren't press conferences. You know, I think that's one of the reasons.
Well, there are press conferences and there are press conferences.
Well, I think that's one of those reasons they aren't wanting to let loose those visitor logs.
Sure.
Because something tells me Jeff's name is mentioned a whole lot.
Oh, I imagine, yeah. Probably delivering pizza, if I recall the scenario correctly.
Oh, let me bring up something here now. But did you see the press conference the other day when Bush decided, well, all this problem with the economy is because of those damn Democrats for the last year?
Yeah. Mm.
Forget that 6 years that the Republicans were leading. No, they had nothing to do with it. Or did you see the thing on 60 Minutes? We got to see Fat Tony try to reinvent his world.
Yeah, Mark Levine did a lovely job of wearing Fat Tony out this evening right before my show.
Oh, okay.
And I had something approaching a low rent aneurysm over the torture is not punishment line too. So,
well, the one I still want him to explain is, gee, why didn't you recuse yourself from Bush v. Gore since your son was working for the Bush election campaign?
Hey, you know, I almost forgot about that one.
You know, him and
you were duck hunting with Dick.
Yes. Well, what was it? Him and Rehnquist both had sons working in the Bush campaign. And Clarence, I can't say a thing without checking with everybody. Without checking with Fat Tony first, his wife is working for the Bush campaign, but none of them think that's any reason to recuse themselves.
No, not at all.
Could you imagine if a third cousin of one of the liberal judges had even said?
Look, no, we don't have to. Look, we don't have to imagine. Because please remember that Mike Huckabee pardoned a rapist who went out and killed again because he was pressured to do so and believed himself that justice was miscarried because it was a Clinton hit job on that poor man.
Forget those witnesses. What if
never mind the witnesses. Never mind the victims. It was them Clintons. You know how they are.
God, you know what I mean? That's one of those things. And then, like I say, here we are with this stuff with the press on John McCain. It's like, isn't it amazing how he's such a maverick, but almost everything they cited him being a maverick on is what he did in 2000? But now almost on every one of those things, he's flipped over to the Bush side. But oops, we can't tell you
Oh,
that.
But yeah, look, I mean, I was just looking at it a little bit ago. He says, you know, back then I thought that mission accomplished was a big mistake. And yet there it is, you know, the quote in print. Of him, yes, yeah. I'm so proud. I'm glad that a mission is accomplished. Yeah. It's just
the other one. You know, this thing where they asked him about the Katrina thing. He said, "Well, I would have turned Air Force One around." Let's see one of them. Isn't it true that he was at your birthday party,
John, you were standing in front of Air Force One, buddy. You didn't tell him to turn it around. You said, "Cut the cake."
It's him sitting there playing air guitar.
I know. Hey, Luke, I got to roll along. I got to try to hit a couple more blankies.
Okay, no. Have a good evening.
All right. See you, Luke. Bye. Our pal Luke in the hills of East Tennessee. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Vince. What's up, brother?
Not much. Yeah. suicide. I believe that.
Yeah. Shot herself in the back of the head 2 times.
Yeah, yeah, that's what the autopsy is going to show. She committed suicide by shooting herself in the back of the head 2 times.
Although, yeah, like I said, they were very specific. She hanged herself with a nylon rope. Because God knows we wouldn't want to make a mistake and say that it was a hemp rope or anything. No.
That was kind of the first thing that kind of struck me. I'm like, man, this is awful specific for this early in the game.
Left 2 suicide notes. Well, I wonder which one she meant to send.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. You know, I bet Vitter is sleeping rather nicely tonight.
Oh, he is sleeping like a baby.
Pun intended.
I'll be here all week. Try the veal.
Dun, dun. Oh, I've been shooting.
That was a beautiful setup, Vince. I didn't think I'd get a chance to do that. That was a beautiful piece of setup work.
I've been, not literally, but I've been reading the local newspaper today. You know, I don't know why this surprises me anymore, but let me just read you the headline here. I'll pull it up here.
Okay.
Because this is how stupid the people in my area are, and I don't know why it surprises me every time. But here's the headline for this particular letter to the editor. Republicans, the wise choice for president. I won't even read the letter because, frankly, it just made my blood boil.
No, go ahead. I mean, you know, all we got in common is our misery. The least we can do is share it. No, go ahead.
All right. Dear editor, this is in response to last week's letter to the editor that started Americans Don't Realize or something to that extent. First of all, I do talk to my neighbors on a regular basis, and they are doing just fine. There are plenty of Americans out there that are just fine. Those Americans that made good financial decisions in life and did not jump into a mortgage that they possibly could not afford. Banks started relaxing their mortgage standards when the Democratic President Bill Clinton was in office. At the time, the Democrats made sure that bankers lent more to lower income families, and you can see where this has them now. The war on Islamic extremists has taken its toll not only with military losses that we have had, but civilian contractors' lives as well. This all started with over 2,974 American lives lost on American soil in 1 day. The Islamic extremists said that it's hard to read this because the grammar is kind of horrible. The Islamic extremists said that if given the opportunity, they will do it again. I hope that you can see this. That this is why we are in Iraq and Afghanistan. Lest we not forget that Saddam Hussein was killing hundreds of his own people for no other reason than they held different beliefs than him. During that time, we had a Democratic president that they would not take this type of behavior seriously. Like I said, the grammar on here is kind of painful.
Well, you know, you're lucky it didn't. You're lucky it wasn't just printed in the original crayon, Vince.
Let me also remind you that the Democratic President Jimmy Carter, we had American hostages taken and held in Iran for more than a year, and it wasn't until the day that Republican President Ronald Reagan took office that they were released. The mainstream media at the time said that the Iranian president feared what would happen under a Republican-led administration. Fast forward to the Clinton administration, where a naval ship was bombed while in harbor, and once again, no retaliation on our part. In Somalia, we had an American soldier dragged through the streets, again with no retaliation, again from a democratically led administration. Fuel prices are at an all-time recorded high, but stop and ask why. Who are the people stopping us from drilling off the coast of Florida? Who are the people holding us back from building a new refinery? There has not been one new refinery built in this country since the 1970s. All those questions can be answered with one word, environmentalists. They are the real reason for high gas prices, not Republicans.
Oh, God.
You want me to stop? I told you it was painful.
Oh, God.
It's almost over.
Okay.
Republicans do not set the price. It's as simple as supply and demand. Right now, we have much more demand than supply. My party of choice is not great, but we have too much government spending and continue to be on lax on immigration. But this country cannot afford another Clinton. This country does need a leader who knows and understands the very basics of economics. Obama has shown in more than one presidential debate that he does not have enough experience or economic understanding to be president. Choose wisely. Choose Republican. And, of course, I'm not going to give out his name, although I kind of wish I could because I'd like people to ridicule him, which I did. I actually wrote back a letter to the editor back to the newspaper.
Wait, we need somebody with a basic understanding of economics and he's voting Republican? Has he? No, this guy doesn't talk to his neighbors, and he does live in a cave. I think it may have been written by Osama, okay? I just do. Because John McCain knows about as much economics as I know about... Oh, dear, I can't think of anything I really know that little about.
Well, at least he knows that little. What scares me is...
Playing the violin. How's that? Yeah. I'm a better fiddler than John McCain is an economist. How's that? And, I mean, I know nothing about a violin.
Luckily, my newspaper is nothing if not balanced. I went ahead and I thought it was going to get rejected because I... over the allotted, write-back amount.
Mm-hmm.
But the editor actually called me back today and was just like, I love your letter, and I just needed to confirm that you live where you live and everything to make sure that I don't get in the hot water for publishing it. And it's apparently going to be in Friday's paper.
Yeah, you. Fight back.
And I mean, I basically... I'm just going to read to you basically the last sentence because I'm sure you're running out of time and have other people. But just... I basically said that, you know, I don't know where he lives, but if he'd talked to me, I'd have told him that I'm not doing fine, and nobody I know is doing fine, and that I personally didn't have a mortgage or anything. And then I was talking about, if nothing's wrong with the gas prices, why are we still going on? Why are both McCain and Clinton going on this tax holiday? Which by the time I get done pumping my gas, I might have enough for a number one at McDonald's if I'm lucky.
Very well done.
Huh?
Very well done.
And then I pointed out that there was no terrorist activity in Iraq until after we invaded. I'll read you that paragraph. Do I need to point out again that there was no terrorist activity in Iraq until after we invaded? Al-Qaeda simply wasn't there any more than Bush's phantom WMDs were, which, by the way, for anyone who's counting, was the original reason we were given for why we had to invade. No mention of Osama bin forgotten.
Hey, by the way, speaking of why we invaded, the falafel boy, O'Reilly?
Right.
Has declared that we did not invade Iraq.
Huh?
Yeah, that's what I said this morning before my first coffee.
Well, wait, he's saying we didn't invade Iraq?
I can prove it.
I would love to see the video for that just so I could scream and ridicule about it.
I've got, oh dear me, hold on just a minute. It's probably right here. In fact, I'm certain that it's almost right here. I'm scrolling for all I'm worth.
While you're scrolling, I'll just read the last paragraph here.
Okie doke.
Because then I went over about how he was talking about Democratic involvement.
Oh, wait. I got it.
Okay, go.
Okay, let's see if it'll play.
We are invading Iraq. We're not in war with Iraq.
We didn't invade Iraq.
Did we go through Congress to invade to go to war? Don't we have to go through the act of
there
Congress?
There was a vote in
it was
Congress.
It was a declaration of war.
It was a declaration of war. It was a declaration to enforce the first Gulf War Treaty, which you don't know anything about, Mr. Ballantyne.
You heard it.
We didn't invade. Wow. What a moron.
Well, yeah, but by the same token, there are members of his demographic that have been clutching for years, Vince, for a way to say we didn't invade. We liberated. Weren't you liberals paying attention? We liberated.
Oh, we liberated. Oh, okay. Okay. Well, tell you what. When can I go fly an airplane into downtown Baghdad and go shopping in Sadr City? When I can do that, I'll say they're liberated. So, anyways, like I said, he was going on the whole thing about, all the bad things Democrats did with foreign leaders and whatnot, and I simply said, okay, well, let me give you a brief history lesson. Iran-Contra, the Mujahideen under Osama bin Laden. Anyone remember the photo of Don Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein? Anybody? Huh?
Yeah, don't all answer at once, yeah.
And then the last paragraph, and I'll just read this to you because I took a lot of time in this. Given the reality of foreign policy of this country over the last 8 years, and given how effective it has been, I don't think I want someone who's so quote unquote experienced in starting wars with no plan, ticking off our enemies and allies alike, torturing so-called enemy combatants, and spying on Americans with no legal justification. Nor do I want someone who says we could be in Iraq for 100 more years. I just don't think we can afford it.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
It was a much longer letter, but, you know, I didn't want to take up all your remaining time. I'm sure there's other people on the line.
Well, actually, it's time for me to roll out. But
oh, well, my clocks must be wrong, Ming.
Well, you probably don't have the highly expensive atomic clock that we have.
Probably not. I'm a big fan of the hand-wound kinds myself, actually.
I am, too, but it's a terrible business we're in where you have to actually... See, as a professional broadcaster, I have to really be able to say what time it is. Or they'll take my license away, Vince.
Oh, wow.
Okay, I'm being a smartass.
I know. All right, Bob, nice talking to you. I'll go ahead and get out of here.
All right, have a great evening, Vince. Great writing, brother.
Thanks a lot.
Bye now. Our pal Vince, living in Republican hell. It is officially a little less than 5 minutes before the hour. Oh, God. And I guess that's it for tonight. Thanks for joining back up after last night's abortive attempt at remote broadcasting. As Billy Shears notes in the closing, with that wonderful quote from John Lennon in the closing of his program every Saturday night, we'll get it right next time. And we will. We really will. Thanks to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org, who makes all the stream, and the archives archive, and the podcast. Single-handedly, Ben Birch saved liberal talk radio when he began the White Rose Society. Many thanks to John Fox and Peter Godbold, respectively, our chief engineer and our IT professional. Peter is on his way with another fabulous edition of the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio show, Strictly Confidential. Thanks, very sincere thanks, to all our friends and my personal heroes at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. You can be part of the solution there just by joining up and joining in the fight to save not only Appalachia, but America and the world. Particular condolences go out to my friend Vernon there, who has lost his mother and will be traveling for her funeral. We're thinking of you, Vernon. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 139 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, in touch with the LGBT community and our straight allies. That has been rewritten for tonight. I found out in the mainstream media today that the homosexual agenda again changed without bothering to inform me, its leader. In any case, the homosexual agenda is now that we shall not talk about gay marriage. We will back off that, and we will begin talking about our straight allies, which is, of course, fine with me. I love our straight allies. We've had so many on the show, and they've been delightful. But now that there has been a change in the homosexual agenda, I will indeed honor that and follow it with all my heart. So again, welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 139 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, in touch with the LGBT community and the straight allies that are backing us up, and no mention of marriage. Strictly Confidential is found exclusively on listener-supported Head On Radio Network. We are brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's CRMW.net. Stop by CRMW.net and see what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Thursday, May the 1st, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m., about 9.02 p.m., Eastern Time, on a Thursday evening, which is May the 1st, also the National Day of Prayer, I might point out, 2008, you're indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to phone in and join in the discussion. I'll be telling you ways to do that in just a moment. If you're listening to one of our podcasts, as so many of the listeners do, so that it fits their own schedules, we welcome you anyway, and thank you for participating in any way you like. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to audio archives from the past shows, as well as to the chat room. Tonight is a good night to join the chat room. They're posting disco balls and talking about Lord knows what. You'll find links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music you hear on the show. You'll also find there links to Head On Radio Network's main site, and you can find out about all the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, as well as you'll locate a PayPal button to make it easier for you to support the Head On Radio Network. The toll-free line is 877 the number 4 head on. That translates into 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333. Rings in West Virginia. Again, that's 304-658-3333. Email arrives to Peter at Head On Radio Network, and I do try to check that during the breaks. And where do we begin? What a day. Got to tell you, I woke up this morning fairly early. I think it was around, well, fairly early for me. It was about 6, quarter to 6. I woke up with a feeling of almost dread